Hare Krishna. We're very sorry to keep all of you waiting. The Sunday Feast lecture went a little bit longer than we had expected. This is my fault. And then we had to take some prasad upstairs. So sorry about the delay to keep you waiting. we've been giving a number of different seminars here at ISKCON Chowpatty. Some on Krishna conscious parenting, children's education, one to teachers at Gopal's Garden School, one to parents of the students there. Each one has a lot of content that's similar, but targeted towards a slightly different audience and with a slightly different objective. And this seminar is actually going to be our... is the most like our standard seminar that we give in different parts of the world. My mother has been giving this seminar on homeschooling all across the United States and now in India as well. And so, so far we've been discussing Krishna conscious parenting, children's education, and so forth in largely general terms in a way that can be applied by families in whatever circumstances they might be. In other words, that they be able to take these principles and apply them if their children are going to school or if the children are going to Gurukul or if the children are being home educated in any kind of context. This seminar is going to be directly about homeschooling itself. So it's going to be very specific in nature. Again, it may be that that homeschooling is not appropriate to everyone in all their circumstances. For some, it may be more practical and more appropriate for the children to go to school, for others to go to the Gurukul. There may be many different ways of creating good education. This seminar's goal is to provide one specific educational alternative, one that has been immensely popular in the United States and Europe, some around 2 million children in the United States today, more than that, are being homeschooled by their parents. So it's a very well-established and recognized method of alternative education. Many of these are Christian families who pull their kids out of the school for many of the same reasons that we might do. So also they want to give a very religiously based, spiritually based education to their children. But all kinds of communities do it as well, and many secular parents who are just interested in giving their students a better education. So it's a very recognized educational alternative. In India, it's just something that's really just catching on, just starting. A few people are talking about it, but it's not so well established as yet. Okay. So that's the purpose of the seminar. How many people here have attended another seminar during this visit? Okay, a good number. So I'm guessing this would be the Krishna Conscious Parenting Seminar in Children's Education. Many of the things you'll find in this seminar are repeats, are repeated from that seminar as well. Or rather, it was the other way around. That seminar repeats many of the things that are found here. Okay, so I apologize if some of it is repetitive for you. But the idea here is that it's all these ideas that we've discussed in general are now specifically targeted towards the idea of homeschooling. Okay, so that's kind of the general idea. Yeah, so we begin with a little bit of background here. Most of you won't need this because you've been attending other programs and so forth, but for those people who are new and are attending their first seminar, just a little bit of context in terms of how we got involved in homeschooling. My parents moved to Boise, Idaho. Boise is a small town in the United States, kind of out in the middle of nowhere. It's about 6 hours from the closest big city. And my father got a job there working for Hewlett-Packard, a laser jet printing company. And when we moved there, there was no temple anywhere in the vicinity. And so my parents decided that, okay, they would, if there was no temple, they'd try to create some kind of association there and began holding programs in their home, kind of a preaching center. and people used to come on a regular basis. Eventually, it grew large enough where we were able to buy the property next door and build a separate temple for their lordships, Shri Shri Radha Banki Bihari. They've been our providers, our protectors, and our proprietors for now over 20 years. Very, very merciful. Shri Shri Radha Banki Bihari, Shri Shri Gornitai, Shri Shri Jagannath Baladev Subhadra. Now there's a nice, beautiful mid-sized temple there with a nice congregation of devotees living around the temple and in the city as well. So when they moved there, I attended school for a couple years. After that, my parents pulled both myself and my younger brother out of school and began homeschooling us. So this seminar is based on my mother's experience of homeschooling and the lessons that we learned along the way and kind of how to create a Krishna conscious method of homeschooling.
Hare Krishna. I'm happy to be here and share some of my experiences about educating my children at home with the hope that many of you can get inspired and be pioneers here in India and do similar things. I've just been here a week and I've been just totally shocked by the way things are in the schools, and especially today's seminar with the younger children between the ages of 8 and 13 and what they had to say about the, you know, what they had to go through in terms of peer pressure and, you know, and so much antagonism or distaste among teachers for anything devotional was really quite shocking, you know, in terms of children laughing at the devotee children because they don't eat onions and garlic and mixing their food with, you know, things like that. And then teachers objecting that they should not be wearing neck beads and, you know, and when I heard the children speak, it just really pained my heart that in such a small age in their childhood, which is meant to be so, you know, fun and so loving, and so that they have to constantly every day go to school and face these pressures among other kids. And practically they don't have any choice because they need playmates, they need people to play with. And the parents, they are helpless. You know, they have so much desire to raise them as nice Krishna conscious kids, but look at what they're fighting with. You know, the pressures of giving them a good education, and I was just really, really shocked. You know, and it really made me more determined to try to share whatever experience I had, This determination, as time goes, becomes more and more as I, hear and watch. But really, when I started my homeschooling education with the children, I really didn't know that I was going to have such a, by Krishna's grace, such a good result. But my faith developed as I went along, I think everybody who's here kind of understands the benefits of homeschooling quite a bit. I mean, Prabhupada really wanted our children, especially children of devotee families, to be pure Vaishnavas. You know, he considered the spiritual education of children as extremely urgent. You know, he in one letter he said that children, if he can raise a generation of Krishna conscious children, Krishna conscious preachers, that would be the glory of the movement as well as the glory of our country. So he was so convinced on the importance of the Vedic education for our children, for our children's lives. And because he gave many examples, he from the Shastras, he talked about Krishna going to Gurukula to get his education. God himself is going to the Gurukula to learn the value of life from under a guru. You know, then he talks about influential citizens in the Vedic times, how they were sending their children to be trained in good qualities like sense control, tapasya, you know, all the good qualities. You know, they had, materially they had everything, but they knew that these qualities were so important just to even raise good people, just to even raise good citizens and good leaders. So in other words, Prabhupada wanted this Vedic education, this spiritual education, not just to create just a society of preachers, But he knew just even to live in this material world and to be good citizens and good leaders and to hold, you know, good jobs and everything, you know, one has to get this. In other words, a good brahmacharya education leads to good grihastha life and then to good vanaprastha life. So Prabhupada stressed the importance of this. And he, of course, he quoted Chanakya Pandit. You know, we have so much conception of what good education is, right? We think, you know, until I understood what Prabhupada, until I became a devotee, education for me meant, okay, I have to find a good school for my children. I have to find, you know, good teachers, good school. And good schools means good jobs, comfortable family life. That's basically what we see education as. But now, as devotees, you know, Prabhupada is challenging us to actually think what real education really is all about, right? So he says that real education is Bhagavat education. It's education that makes the children think and inquire, you know, about questions, athato brahma jigyasa, about who are we, why are we here, and what is the purpose of life. So that is real education. So he encouraged, you know, the parents of children to give the children an opportunity to get the spiritual education and not to deny them and not to spoil them with all kinds of material facilities, you know, at the cost of spiritual education. And we see that in India a lot. We are all victims of that, right? We Prabhupada says how family life is such, you know, just has so many ropes of perfection. It's very hard to train our children. And that's why he wanted a Gurukula, because he knew that in family life it's hard to train a child, right? So we are fighting against a lot of odds, you know, right now. But with the way the situation is right now, you know, with the Gurukula, you know, being very few, and how much can they hold, how much capacity can they have, we see that our options, that we have to come up to that point where we have to make our home into a Gurukula. What does Gurukula mean? Guru means teacher, and ashram is the home. So if the parents become the gurus, and the home becomes an ashram, then we will have fulfilled Prabhupada's desire of training our children at home. So Prabhupada, you know, in sixth canto, he talks about, you know, how so many stories like that. It talks about how in the chapter of how Prajapati Daksha curses Narad Muni, in a purport he writes how he sent his second group of sons to the same place to do tapasya, and even though the first group of sons was spoiled by Narad Muni and they went, they did not go towards family life and they became brahmacharis, still Prajapati Daksha considered that his duty. Even though he was so mad and he cursed Narad Muni, he still considered his duty to give his children spiritual education. So he says that every dutiful father and mother should not stop the child from getting this kind of spiritual education. So whether, you know, and then it's up to them what kind of direction they want to take. What kind of occupation, whether they want to be grihastha or stay brahmacharis or whatever occupation they want to follow. So here in homeschooling, the reason why we are considering homeschooling here is because we are not happy with the way things are out there. We are not happy with the public schools. And it happened with me. I was very, very dissatisfied. When my children went to school, they came home, they were so tired. No matter what I did, they were not, you know, ready to sit down with anything devotional. Their brains were just bombarded with so many things out there. It was hard for them to think, you know, to sit down with anything, you know, devotional. So I was, you know, I knew that my efforts would be very, very hard and sometimes very fruitless. So that's you know, that's a drawback in public schools. So however, Prabhupada makes a very strong statement against public schools, and he talks about how, you know, modern schools are like slaughterhouses. Why? Because they're teaching all the children only the concept that we are the body. There's no mention of the soul. He says there's no department in the university or school that talks about the soul. The children are encouraged to learn that the purpose of life is simply to eat, sleep, mate, and defend. But he says that just analyze, do we really need an education for all these four things? No. You know, he gives the example of a child, you know, if a small baby, you give him some cookie or some food or something, immediately he puts it in his mouth. He knows where to put it. He doesn't put it to his hand or leg or anything. He knows the mouth is the place where the food is going to go. You know, similarly, we don't need training for sleeping. We don't need training for sex education. No, it's these things, by innate nature, we know. So to go to school just to learn these things, he said, is not necessary. Obviously, education is meant for a higher purpose. So animals cannot think for anything higher than that, but as children, they can think about the higher purpose of life. The purpose is to restrict these four activities and instead to think, you know, about questions like, who are we, why are we here, and what is the purpose of life, and what our relationship with God is. So Chanakya Pandit said, the test of good education is three things. To consider all women except our wife as mother, to consider others' property as unattractive, and to consider all living entities equal, like ourselves. So he says, Prabhupada explains that if a child grows up in an atmosphere where he looks at every woman and sees her as a mother, whoever comes in front of him sees as a mother, how can he go wrong socially or morally? And that's, you know, that here is itself, just that is such a lot of character training for a child, isn't it? And to consider all living entities as oneself means that just like we have pain and pleasure, we should consider that anybody who's, you know, who's given pain also experiences the same thing. So what child is going to eat meat and try and see the animals being killed? Whether we believe in the soul or not, but still to understand that if you give pain to somebody, then that person will feel the same pain that we feel. So this is the test of good education. And this is what we need to teach our children, this character training that Prabhupada emphasizes so much in all his purports and his books. We can see that no matter how much academic excellence we can give our children, but if he doesn't have good character, it's hopeless, it's useless, isn't it? So, you know, what is the use of just raising children who are, you know, are cheating and hypocrites and all those things? There's enough of that in the world. So he said the duty of a father and mother is to make sure that when they have children, that that child will not come back into another womb. He said that should be the solemn promise of father and mother. Otherwise, he should not be a father and mother. He says that's very, very important. And if you don't give that Bhagavad education, then we should not be surprised if children become disrespectful and to elders. Why should we be surprised? He says the Muslims, they teach their children from day one the Quran. But as Hindus, we hesitate to teach our children Bhagavad Gita or give them any kind of spiritual education. So why should we be surprised when they misbehave? When we have educated them to understand that the body is all in all, and to gratify the senses is all in all. In other words, we are making them into sense gratifiers at a very, very early age. He says, then we have completely spoiled their brains because that's all they know. So any time, when the children are little, they're very, very sweet. We all have experience. But as they get older, then these problems start coming. So when they've been taught that the body is all in all and the purpose of life is to gratify your senses and your body, then when we don't give them something they want, then they are going to rebel and they are going to be disrespectful. So we have to be, so this is the reason why Prabhupada stressed on the Gurukula system, which we now can adapt into our lifestyle in a different way, you know, because as parents we can give them pretty much the same kind of training, if you want. So, my homeschooling, the basic principle of my homeschooling was that Krishna conscious lifestyle was the basis of my homeschooling. It wasn't that homeschooling was the basis. In other words, Krishna consciousness was not a part of the homeschooling system that I had. In other words, our lifestyle was Krishna conscious, and homeschooling was one part of it. So we did, just like we lived in the house, and I homeschooled my children just like a devotee would live in an ashram or in a house. Okay. So in other words, we did whatever a devotee would do in the morning in terms of getting up for the morning program, you know, reading the scriptures, then getting ready for practical devotional activities for the rest of the day, you know. So this was really what our homeschooling was all about. So Krishna, because the purpose of homeschooling is to raise a Krishna conscious child, so Krishna conscious lifestyle becomes the basis of homeschooling. Many times we think that when we homeschool our children, so all we can think about is academics, you know, how we have to train them into being, good in academics. But really, being a Krishna conscious child means good education. In other words, if you train them nicely spiritually, education will automatically follow. And we experience that in our life. You want to say something? Of course, Prabhupada, stresses to do that, of course, is we need a Krishna conscious lifestyle and also a good example. He said, more important than precept is our own example. Precept is important, but until the child can follow a good example, precept has no value. And we see that in the scriptures. I mean, Lord Chaitanya, by his own example, he showed. I mean, he had his followers write all the literature, but he himself came to show us what is, what is it like to be a good devotee. So example is very important for our parents, just like he talked about how in the Gurukula, it was so important for the teachers who lived with the children to be very exemplary. Why? Because they have such intimate association with the children all day. So parents are similarly, when they live with the children, they are very intimately associating with them. And the children are heavily depending on them for their character training, for their intelligence, for their good character. So we should not underestimate that. We should try to be, set a good example. Of course, for myself, I can say I wasn't anyway perfect when I started homeschooling. I was also, I was a new devotee, and I was struggling, with things. But, my eagerness to want to make them devotees, pushed me into, trying to be one. In other words, because I knew if I had to preach to them, I would have to also follow those same principles. So, in other words, trying to make my children Krishna conscious also helped my own Krishna conscious, also helped me become a better devotee. So, we can cover that now. So anyway, many people here, I'm sure, who are considering homeschooling might be, whenever I go everywhere to do my seminars, there's so many parents who would like to do, but they're so fearful. They're so fearful because they feel like they're not qualified. They're not qualified spiritually or academically. They feel the teachers over there are better qualified. But Prabhupada says, in the Vedic times, the teacher was not only qualified, in terms of having a knowledge of the scriptures, but they were also qualified in terms of character, So they were really totally qualified to give love and guidance to our children. But sometimes we feel like, how can we be like them? We are not like them. But like I talked earlier, when we train our children morally, then we ourselves are, those same qualities rub on us. And similarly with academic qualifications, when we teach them, when we teach them through Prabhupada's books, then the books speak for themselves. In other words, as we follow Prabhupada's books, as we read them, we become more and more convinced. In other words, Prabhupada said, education doesn't mean, intelligence doesn't mean how many academic degrees we can collect, right? He said all the degree, holders, it doesn't mean, he said these degree holders, their intelligence is stolen by illusion. They it doesn't mean that they're intelligent. Intelligence comes from Krishna. So when Krishna is a source of all knowledge, material, spiritual, so when we understand Krishna, the source, then that is real intelligence. And so if you have faith and trust in Prabhupada and his teachings, and as we teach from his books, the intelligence will come. and we are qualified to teach. So it doesn't depend on our academic degrees, how many degrees we've collected. Even a high school educated person. I have a family in Boise, across the street from the temple, and she's not even high school. She's got four children, and her children are doing so well homeschooling. They're doing well academically, and they're such nice devotees. So we'll move on.
Now we'll move into the kind of the practical aspects of setting up the home and arranging the curriculum in terms of teaching for homeschooling. And the seminar is divided into three parts. Each are based on an important, a frequent motto that we hear in ISKCON, and that is purity is the force, books are the basis, and preaching is the essence. And so we'll cover various items under each one of these three categories, starting with the topic of purity and how to prepare the home in order to make it a suitable place for an educational experience. And like my mother was saying, the home can be created into a gurukula, basically, and how that can be done. So the very first thing is turning off those things which pollute the atmosphere of the home. Those of you who have attended our seminars in the past will know how kind of important this particular aspect is in order to create that positive atmosphere in the home and make it Krishna conscious, which is turning off the television. Right? The television and anything else that comes in the form of a screen, namely video games, as well as computers and the internet, all of these are mechanisms by which Maya can directly access us in this age of Kali Yuga. Right? In previous ages, in order to see men and women behaving very loosely and engaging in illicit behavior, one would have to go to a particular section of town, a very bad section of town, and you'd have to go there and risk being seen by others and losing your reputation and doing all. It would be a very dangerous act. Today, you can just turn on the television, right, or go to the internet, and all those sinful activities come directly to us into our own home. So basically, Maya, she's gotten this means of accessing us that is free of any barriers, no social barriers, no spiritual barriers, no any kind of barriers. She comes directly into our living rooms, into our own bedrooms, and talks to us directly. Mother Urmila, one of the senior educators within ISKCON, she calls the television the one-eyed guru. And the reason she calls it that is because whatever we see in front of the television, we sit there and the television downloads all kinds of information on us, and we accept it. Especially children are very, very prone to accepting whatever they see as truth. This is how they learn. They see their parents, they imitate them. They see something on television, they imitate it also. In terms of TV, there's two basic major problems with it. One is the method by which it teaches, the means by which it teaches. Basically, the method of teaching, the method of conveying information as it's found in the television dulls the intelligence and destroys creativity. Take, for example, when you're reading a book. When you read a book, you have to work to get the words off of the page, right? To understand what's... You have to actually pick up the book and you have to read, and that takes effort. Once you understand what's there, then you create an image in your mind, right? And through imagination. Suppose it's a beautiful scene being described. So you see the scene in your mind. And in that way, you're able to appreciate what goes on. In the radio, something a little different goes on. You don't have to do much effort to get the information yourself. It's kind of sent to you through the medium of sound. But you still have to create the picture in your head, right? You still have to use the faculties of imagination and creativity. The problem with television is that you don't have to do anything, right? It's completely given to you. You don't have to work to get the information. It's spoon-fed. And then you don't even have to create the picture. No imagination is required. Everything is seen literally, verbatim, like that. So it makes for a very dull mind. People become morons by watching television. It's just a download, a one-way download, without any kind of intellectual work happening. So intellectually speaking, as a means of learning, it's a very great waste of time and something that causes dullness. The second problem with television is its content. One is the medium of learning, the style of conveying information, and the second is the content itself. We are all well aware that basically all the four regulated principles are broken on television. Meat eating, illicit sex, gambling, intoxication. These tend to be the pillars of what is offered on television, because unless these are present in some way or another, no program is attractive to anyone. And then, of course, there are the commercials in between. If we think, well, okay, the children will only watch children's shows, kids' shows, or educational shows. The advertisements that are given in between, who are they targeted towards? The children. Right? It's all directed towards the children. They target it very, very specifically. And those repeated advertisements over and over again, they create the desire. They increase all these desires so strongly. They create needs, desperate needs for things that we didn't know we needed. And we suddenly discover we need them. They've done studies showing that when someone watches an advertisement, it takes by about the seventh time of watching that advertisement, they become determined to buy the product. Right? If you ever wonder why they keep showing the same advertisement over and over and over and over again on television, to the point ad nauseum, you know, to the point where. And you've seen it. You just saw it 5 minutes ago, right? But there's another break, and again, you see the same thing. Why? Because first time you think about it, right? Second time you become a little more serious. Third time, it's exactly described in Bhagavad Gita. Dhyayato vishayan pungsa sangasteshu pajayate sangha sanjayate kama. Then you develop. By about the seventh time, your kama, the lust is there. I got to have it. That new iPhone or iPod or this wonderful Lux soap or whatever it is. Right? I have to have it. And then for children, they want it. This means all kinds of desires. When they go to the market, I want this, mommy, I want that, daddy, and my friends have this, and I don't have that, and I saw this on television. And if you don't, if we say no to those desires, then what happens? Kamat krodho vijayate. Then temper tantrums and anger and all kinds of things. So television, basically, it creates a very difficult environment. In which to cultivate a Krishna conscious lifestyle. It's like trying to work so hard in one direction and then, you know, trying to start a fire and pouring water on it at the same time. It destroys the spiritual atmosphere, and it creates all kinds of material desires and so forth. So it's kind of a first principle that we begin with is not watching television, video games. Today we can extend that to the internet. Right? Internet is an increasingly problematic thing. For both of these reasons. The most important part of the internet, the problem of the internet, is that you don't know where the content is coming from. People have this tendency to feel that whatever you find on the internet, on the screen, is true. Somehow if it's on a website, it must be true. I struggle with this with my own students in the university so much. You give them a paper to write on a particular topic, an essay, and they'll just go to the internet, do a web search, go to Wikipedia, find the relevant passages, do a cut and paste, and put it on their essay. Say, see, I got everything about it. And I have to ask them, do you have any idea whether what you're quoting has any truth to it? For all you know, it could be rumor or gossip. Right? How is it any better than what you hear from your friends or from the tea stall or, you know, the local gossip column? How can it be any better? There's no source attached to most of the content on the internet. And according to our tradition, according to our shastras, we hear that content, the content of knowledge, is not as important as the source. Right? The source is as important or more important than the content itself. Because if you know that the source is good, then the content is automatically trustworthy. Because a good source is not going to give you bad content. But if you just know the content, then there's no guarantee whether that content is correct, whether the person was trying to cheat you or not. You have no idea whatsoever. Right? So the internet is kind of, it's information. It's information, but it's not knowledge. There's a big difference between the two. We've got so much information in the world, but very little knowledge. And then, of course, the same problem of content is also there. Statistics show that more than 90% of all the content on the internet is pornography. The vast majority of what's conveyed on the internet are things that are completely contrary to the principles of Krishna consciousness. So all these things need to be very, very carefully controlled in terms of the home environment. And it really goes a long way towards creating a positive Krishna conscious environment. Sometimes people ask, well, if my children don't watch television, then will they be able to function in society? Will they be able to speak intelligently in front of others? They won't have a clue what's going on. But the fact of the matter is that the amount of knowledge that you require to converse intelligently in the world, if you just read the headlines on a newspaper, and maybe the first paragraph of each article, journalists are trained to put all the essential information of an article in the first paragraph. They're supposed to do this because most people don't read to the end of the article anyway. So they have to do this. So if you read the headlines, that in itself is usually sufficient. But if you need a little bit more, first paragraph of each article. Just on the front page of the newspaper, you know more than enough to hold an intelligent conversation with anyone you meet. Maybe you won't know the latest details and gossip, right? The little small items of this and that. But that's okay, right? We don't have to be the most popular in terms of, you know, showing our knowledge of the world and how good we are. Our goals are different in life. We want to impress Krishna. We want to impress the spiritual master. We don't need to impress our friends in terms of our social knowledge of the world. So a little bit, if we're lacking in that, it's okay. It's not any great problem.
I just was thinking about another thing, how many parents told me how children don't listen to them. They try so hard. He says, whatever I tell them, they tell me they want to do just the opposite. And TV, I think, has a lot to do with that because, you know, it comes in the form of authority, you know. And so, you know, children tend to, you know, accept that authority versus the authority of their parents. So that becomes also a problem, you know, when we have a problem with children listening to us, you know. And one other point was that it makes children mentally lazy because, you know, they don't have to exercise their brain. So in America, the statistics is that children who watch TV, they have a hard time with things that require a lot of brain work, like math and things, and they cannot focus their minds. So so we have to be careful about that. Another other things that help, that are conducive to keeping a nice Krishna conscious environment, because we're trying here to raise a Krishna conscious child, is the morning program, you know. So morning program is very, very good. You know, we are all, we are all habitual by nature. You know, we like discipline in our life, and discipline helps in controlling our minds and making it peaceful. So children are restless by nature. So by keeping a nice morning program every day for them, they become peaceful. And really a lot of the behavior problems just goes away just by that. Actually, Prabhupada wanted children to, you know, attend the morning program so much because he said, you know, in fact, that was the only austerity he wanted the children to go through. He said, let them get up for Mangal Arati, let them attend the morning program, and then they can do whatever. They can play, dance, run around, you know, read Shastra. So this is, and there's a reason, a scientific reason, because it calls for a trained mind, a peaceful, happy mind. And of course, we have to be in a home situation, we have to be practical, you know, sometimes because of the nature of our family life, you know, fathers coming home late and you know, festivals. We had a preaching center and sometimes late nights. And it's difficult. You know, children need their rest, you know. Prabhupada said at least they should get at least 8 to 9 hours of rest before we wake them up. So in situations like that, we can, you know, wake them up a little later. But still, we should try not to miss the morning program. In other words, we should always start the day with the morning program. So we used to do that. You know, so it would take like 2-3 hours. So by the time they finished, I mean, you know, finish morning prayer. They, you know, you could really teach them. They were motivated to learn, and I was motivated to teach. You know, if you've gone through a morning program, then you really, you know, you have like little saints around, really, literally, running around. They are still naughty, but really in a transcendental way. It's different. The naughtiness is different. So it really is very, very purifying, the program in the morning. And we can have the training is done right there just by doing that, you know. So Prabhupada said it should be done, however, in a way that children enjoy these austerities. It should never be presented in a way that they feel a burden. They feel it's a punishment. And that happens if the parents participate with the children. It's not like we are sleeping and they're up. So we participate with the children and make it so much fun. Loudly chanting, dancing. You know, the child doing, we taking turns. Sometimes the child doing Mangal Aarti dressed up as a pujari. You know, the smaller children also participating. In other words, sometimes it becomes very difficult because they run around, they misbehave, and so we feel like okay, maybe we can skip it or whatever. But gradually, as they do it, they'll actually start enjoying it and liking it, and then it'll become their way of life. And the day you miss it, they're really actually going to miss it. And of course, japa also is nice to encourage. Prabhupada was very keen on encouraging children to do japa, but not forcing them. Definitely not to force them. They should be encouraged in the sense that we should give them beads whenever they're ready. Even at 3, you can give them beads as long as they're taught how to respect them. You know, we can encourage them to even chant half around. And gradually, they will take it up. When my children were small, I never left them alone. I always chanted with them. I never left them chanting alone because I didn't want them to develop bad habits. And I also wanted to make it fun for them. I would remind them about Krishna and tell them so that they could, they could enjoy the whole process. So another factor in purifying the home is eating prasadam, only prasadam. And sometimes we tend to, especially in India, where there's so much food available out there. You know, in America, you know, just, you know, and it looks so good. I mean, it looks like normal food. I mean, anywhere you can get dal, rice, chapati, and you look at that and you say, what is the difference, you know? And so many mothers in the last few days have said, is it okay if they did this? And is it okay if they went to a neighbor's house and they offered and there's no onions and garlic and it's okay, what can they eat? Prabhupada, you know, just like you can tame any animal by giving it food, right? So similarly, you can tame the restless mind of a child just by giving him prasadam. You know, it was Lord Chaitanya's very powerful weapon for this age of Kali. You know, this was his process, the chanting of the holy name and prasadam. So we cannot, you know, minimize the whole importance of prasadam. You know, we have experienced how, you know, just a plate of prasadam will melt even the coldest hearts. No matter how much you talk to them, preach philosophy, you know, I know your Guru Maharaj, Hanumat Preshak Swami, he used to, you know, conduct these science and religion conferences, right? And he was talking about how these noble laureates, you couldn't, you know, melt their hearts. But as soon as prasadam was served, you know, immediately, their hearts would melt. So prasadam is very, very powerful. And we can do that. And in the beginning, children need a lot of variety. And so it's important to give them that variety so that their senses can be controlled. They are happy, you know. Eating is a big, important activity for them, you know. So we can cook different things for them. But as they get older, it's not so necessary to make so much variety. Because other interests take over and they become satisfied with simple prasadam. That's what happened with my children. And it really pays off later on in life when they're out there and, you know, and prasadam is difficult to get. Then they still try to, you know, do the best under the circumstances and still try to avoid non-offered food. You want to talk a little bit about
that? Yeah. Well, one of the things I remember most in this regard is my father, he used to travel a lot on business trips for his company. And everywhere he went, he insisted on eating only prasad. And that often meant taking a lot of prasad from home, that my mother would cook and pack. But sometimes these trips would last long when they were international trips, and the food would run out from home. And he was still very determined that I'm only going to eat prasadam. And in some places, like if he was traveling the Far East or someplace like that, it's difficult even to find vegetarian food, what to speak of prasadam. People don't have a concept of vegetarian food. So he sometimes survives many days on just, you know, fruits and nuts and salad, but always kind of made it a point that it would not be any food cooked by non-devotees. And that made a really strong impression on me. And as I grew up, and then now I'm also working, I'm teaching at a university, and many times, many occasions call for some kind of social occasion. The professors will invite you out for an evening dinner, or we're interviewing a candidate for a new position, and we have to meet them over lunch or over dinner. And you have to go. It's a social obligation. You have to go. But just remembering my father's example, it gives me a lot of strength that, okay, I'm going, but I have to stick to my principles. And I called the restaurant in advance and asked them to make a nice fruit plate. I say, can you please just cut up fresh fruit and arrange it on a plate, and that's all I'll have. And because that's all I'm taking, they really make a big effort to make it nice, you know? So when it shows up there, then everyone on the table is like, wow, that's amazing. Someone in the kitchen really likes you, huh? And I said, no, it's just fruit. That's all it is. They said, wow, you eat healthy. This is good, you know. And we should all eat like this. And so people, they get a strong message. And at the same time, you feel good that, okay, I stuck to my Krishna consciousness. Even as children, going to like friends' parties or birthday parties, places like that, sometimes there's cake served which has eggs in it. This is more and more common in India also. Eating of eggs is very frequent. Or there were some other items, cookies and things that you know, were not suitable. None of it was prasadam. So my mother, what she would do is really feed us a lot just before we left for the party. And then she'd take some nice item with us to the party, which would be like for everyone to eat. But we would eat that. And so we wouldn't feel left out. We'd look good in front of our friends. Even with our friends asked us, okay, why are you not eating this? We kind of felt, my brother, he recalls how he used to feel like you know, he had a secret pact with Krishna that he was only going to eat prasadam. And he and Krishna knew that, okay, this is we're devotees of Krishna, and this is what we do. And of course, it gives opportunities for preaching. I mean, as little children generally have fewer inhibitions than the adults do. And so they're very forthcoming and, you know, going to friends and saying, why are you not eating the cake? Well, it has baby chickens in it, you know. You're eating baby chickens. You know it has eggs in it. And they go, oh, and the little kids, you know, they're like, oh, my God, this has eggs? Baby chickens? And say, yeah, that's why we don't eat. And then they go to their parents and say, mommy, why are you feeding me cake with baby chickens in it? You know, and like that. So they're very, children are generally quite fearless, actually, in this matter, especially when they're younger. And it's more the adults that are worried about fitting in and so forth. So seeing a good example from parents really helps. It provides the basis for being strict about prasadam for the rest of their lives, basically. What I learned from my parents early on, that gives me strength so I can practice it now that I'm in the world like them.
So another point that we're going to discuss here is good association. And as devotees, we all understand that what a strong effect it can have on children is association. So Prabhupada gave the example of the movie Tarzan, you know, how he lived with monkeys, right? So when he lived with monkeys, he developed the habits of monkeys. So in other words, children, whoever they associate with, those are the qualities. If they associate with saintly people, they become like demigods, very saintly also. And if they associate with, you know, bad people, then they become like demons. So Prabhupada said that children had no independent psychology, he said. They're very innocent. He even said they were like animals, like, you know, children and animals are very similar, pet animals like that. So it depends. So whatever we train them, in whatever way we train them, that's going to be how they're going to become. So they, we can mold them. And he gave the example of just like a person doesn't grow up liking smoking and drinking. You have to actually develop a taste for smoking and drinking. Right? It's not like by birth you like that kind of thing. So similarly, you know, children, by nature, they are not bad. You know, they automatically won't. They, unless they are in bad association, they will not become bad. So we have to be very careful in giving them very good association right from the beginning of their life. And of course, there's two types. Our own association as parents by setting good examples. We see in America today, children, you know, they need such good role models. But children over there, they have such bad role models. They are film stars and sports athletes. And they are, you know, their character is very, very questionable. And sometimes the result is so disastrous. You know, children kill themselves by imitating them. So giving them good role models for parents and for other elders in the community, you know, that they can emulate is very important. And that can happen, that can easily happen when we always keep them with us. We never leave our children alone. That's very important. Not to leave our children with maids at home or with people and then going off to do our work or other services. You know, we have to, if we have, you know, things to do, we should just keep them with us and also engage them. So if we don't keep the children with us, then they lose interest. And that's why we have this problem. I have talked to so many mothers and they tell me that when I go to the temple, the children are so happy. Now I've gotten rid of my mother. She's gone, and now I can do what I want to. And these are devotee children. They are children from devotee families. So obviously there's something wrong, you know. We have not been able to cultivate that same, that interest, that love for Krishna, that love for devotional service. And we sometimes it's not, you know, the fault of the parents completely. I mean, we are new devotees and we are very fired up, you know. We want to serve Krishna, we want to do so much. So, but we have to be careful. Prabhupada said, children are like deities. So if you do good Krishna conscious training for our children, it becomes pure devotional activity. That's how seriously we have to take, you know, in training our children. We should consider that as a number one objective, yes.
What should have preference? She was asking Prabhupada, should I give Jubala Priti to someone else to be taken care of, and I take care of the deities because there's so much to be done in the deity department. And Prabhupada said, no, Jubala is your deity.
And Jubala was her daughter?
Yeah.
So here we have, you know, Mother Nataki telling us, you know, directly about that. So we should have no doubt about that.
We were at that time, we were not from this culture, and to, you know, because Prabhupada told us, you know, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and how we should be so careful in taking care of him in his deity form like that, and mm-hmm. how there's so many offenses to be committed and whatever. And that what Prabhupada said was so striking to us because we were so immature in our Krishna consciousness that we were for sure, we were surely thinking that he would say, no, you take care of the deities and someone else can take care of Jugala Priti, you know, because that's, we were immature, you know, like that.
Right. Thank you. Thank you. That was very nice. So, should I go to the next one? Early years? Okay. So now we can move on to the next slide. And so Krishna consciousness, you know, people ask, you know, when to begin? When does Krishna consciousness training actually begin? So it begins right from day one, right from the, you know, right even before the child is born. So the reason is that Prabhupada actually said that whatever training that we give our children for the first 5 years, you can, is laying the foundation for the future of the child. In other words, you can pretty much predict what the child is going to be for the rest of the life. Of course, they might get sidetracked a little bit in the middle sometime, but they come back, because if the early part of training is good, if the early part of training is really good training. And practically what it means is that when children are very, they're just babies, it means that the whole atmosphere of the house should be surcharged with Krishna consciousness. In other words, there should be constant chanting, you know, glorification of Krishna in some way or the other, you know, prasadam distribution, preaching, you know. So if you have that kind of environment at home, even the babies are affected. What I would do is I would, besides, you know, having that kind of environment, I would put deities or pictures of Krishna very strategically, you know, next to the child, so that he could always watch, you know, Krishna like that. So we can do so many things like that, you know, where the child is, you know, being exposed to Krishna, even in that early part of her life or his life. And of course, as they get older and toddlers, they are toddlers or preschoolers, it's a difficult age where they are just constantly running around, throwing things. So children at that age, they have a desire to play all the time. We all know as parents, they just want to play, play, play. And so Prabhupada said that the way we can train them is we can dovetail the desire to play into doing Krishna conscious activities. And that means that, you know, the games should be very much, you know, games that they can revolve around Krishna. You know, like imitating a temple lifestyle. You know, giving them toys instead of plastic, artificial toys. Giving them toys in which they can imitate like a temple lifestyle. You know, a kitchen set where they can cook and make prasadam and imitate us in the kitchen like we do in the kitchen, right? Worshipping, serving Krishna, like that. And of course, for outdoor games, you know, running around, they can imitate Krishna and his cowherd boyfriends in Vrindavan or stories from Ramayana. Now, these things look so simple, and they say, oh, you know, we grew up with this thing in this culture, but we think it's, you know, it's something very ordinary. But actually, it's very, very important, because the more we put the children in that association of Krishna, the more he's going to become a good devotee. The more he's going to imbibe the qualities of Krishna. And Prabhupada said that we should not let them waste any time. Even though the children, the tendency is, okay, you know, we get too busy and we just put them in front of a television or a Krishna conscious video game or whatever, Krishna conscious video. So because we become busy, but it's important that children do not waste time. In other words, whatever they're doing, even if they're playing, it should be very beneficial for them. And what we did as a family, the way I engaged my children when they were little, I took them everywhere I went. So no matter what I did, I took them with us. Whether they could participate in it or not, it didn't matter. But they were observing, and that observation led them to be attracted to devotional service. So if I went on Harinam or went on book distribution or preaching activities, wherever I went, I took them with me. So they could constantly absorb, observe, you know, and that would rub on them. Another thing that children can take up, which is very, very important, is deity worship. Deity worship is very important. Yes, Prabhu. Yes. Right. Mm-hmm.
You show them some Krishna conscious movie or video, something like that. But then when it's over, again they come back. Now what should we do? So we don't want them to waste time either. But how do you keep them engaged when they keep coming back to you like a genie, you know, that now give me something to do, now give me something to do. So.
You know, the way I did it was rather than put them, you know, for too long in front of a, you know, video, I would... just keep them with me. No, whatever I did, they just were with me and assisted me. Now, that requires a little bit of patience, you know, to be with them like that. But, you know, it's better than trying to, leaving them alone doesn't get you any good results. Pretty soon they're going to be not want Krishna consciousness. They get a negative impression of Krishna consciousness. Yeah, that's okay. Krishna conscious videos is okay, and especially little children. There's one little girl in Boise. She watches one. She must have watched one show hundreds of times, and she's very Krishna conscious girl. Very nice girl. But as they get older, naturally we have to limit it because there's other important things they need to do. So maybe you can just limit it for an hour a day or something like that. But to just leave them there because we have such important things to do is not a good idea. So if the mother is cooking in the kitchen, she can have the children in the kitchen, helping them. I know they create a big mess, but then, you know, yeah. But then, you know, I used to face the same thing, but, you know, they were also my helpers. So they would understand that, okay, we all have to clean up after that. So, you know.
I spent so much time in the kitchen, I could make chapatis by the age of 3.
We had a restaurant also, Mother Notagi remembers that, and children learned to cook and assist, you know, all kinds of things. Well, the results will bear fruit later, you know, because in the beginning there's a lot of hard work because children tend to be naughty and, you know, we have our own sadhana and so many things to do and they're always in the way and it becomes, but if we do that, you know, sacrifice and that hard work in the beginning, then later on they lead your way. I mean, they teach you and they help you, yes. 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 Such wonderful points Mother Nataki is making, that of keeping the children always with us makes them feel that they are important, you know. And I remember that when we were running a preaching center, no matter what decision we made, the children were always in that decision making process, you know, they never. Maybe Radhika, you want to talk about. So anyway, so just by giving them that that feeling of, you know, that they are important to us. In fact, actually, I remember we were so hard pressed for time and, you know, so much services to do that we gave them this feeling that practically that we couldn't even live without them, without their help. You see? Yeah. You need to get the mic. Nobody can hear. Do you have? Can you turn the mic on? Yeah, please.
Also, I felt it was a very good decision on your part to choose to go to Boise and to open up your own temple, to have your own, at first the restaurant and then the temple. Because, and I'm saying this because here in Gopinath Mandir, of course, we like the association of the devotees here, and, you know, but if you're in a maha big temple, there is something that is missing, that is you don't have to head up or lead all the programs yourself. Everything is dished out. It's almost not quite like a TV, but things are dished out to you. I mean, you know, it's also enriching, of course, you know, but if you have to do it yourself, just imagine if you have to go to your own, you have your own center in the nowhere of Rajasthan or somewhere in a small town in Rajasthan or so, then your children and everyone is required, but that builds up so much Krishna consciousness in your children. So I feel the devotee shouldn't feel hesitant to also reach out and go to smaller villages in India, smaller towns and villages to spread the holy name, I think, because you can see the result here.
One of the things I remember most in this regard is that my parents never went anywhere without us. And if there was some party at work or some social occasion, and if children were not invited, then they didn't go either. And again, that just made us feel like so much wanted and so much like part of the family. And I know in the temple, like on many occasions, there was something happening and we were discussing it as a family, and we would chime in and say something, give advice. And I know at that age, most of our advice was really immature, and it didn't add much to the conversation. It was probably a botheration, but nevertheless, our parents kind of made us feel that, oh, you're an important contributing member of the family. And always being treated that not as a child, but as an equal, even though they were constantly trying to train us as children, but we felt like contributing members of the family, not like, okay, you're off to the side, you're a little child, now stay in your own area, and we'll do the adult thing. And I remember going once to a family's home, they were an acquaintance, and the host kept saying, that's the room for the children, you can play with the friends. And we were like really like upset, like, why do we have to go there? Why can't we stay here with everyone? Because that was our habit, and they always, my parents always made it, you know, like important that they made us feel that, yes, you should be here, you're part of the family, even when most of the time we were probably not contributing much in terms of the what was actually going on.
So we can go on to the next slide. On deity worship, I was amazed when I read a quotation by Bhaktivinoda Thakur where he says that any religion that has no provision for deity worship has, you know, and children raised in that that environment, they tend to become materialists or atheists. So in other words, deity worship is so important, it's the foundation of humanity. So deity worship helps in many, many respects because it helps a child focus on Krishna. Besides the other, you know, advantages of cleanliness and punctuality, of course, in a home situation, it's hard to, you know, imitate a temple, you know, standard. But still, you know, the children learn so many, you know, things like, okay, I have to take a shower before I enter the deity room, you know, right? And so many nice qualities like that. You know, the act of offering everything to Krishna, even clothes and, you know, books and whatever. So without deities in the house, Prabhupada was said for householders, deity worship was a must. Otherwise, we can't, you know, be Krishna conscious because we won't be trained to be clean. So we had that in our house, and this is a very very good thing to introduce in the early part of a child's life and continue that later as well. So when my children were 3 and 5 years old, I introduced deity worship, and the deities that they had were the ones that Mother Nautaki gave them. I don't know if you remember. They were 4-inch Gauranithai deities that they had, and they started worshipping them. And I was with them, and they're so small. Actually, it's not recommended that children that young worship deities. But I let them do that because I was with them, watching them and training them. And we would spend several hours just bathing them, you know, clothing them, decorating them. And then we would put them back on the altar and then, go to the kitchen, make an offering, offer the food, do an aartik, and then we would read, you know. And of course, we would break for prasadam whenever they were hungry. That is a must, you know. So that would take like several hours a day. So the way I reasoned was, if I don't do this, I have to do something with them. They have to play. So Prabhupada said, deity worship is such a nice way in dovetailing their playing tendency, you know, because it's so beneficial. Of course, many times it's not practical for children to have deities. Then we can give them Krishna dolls, you know, Krishna and, you know, Krishna Balaram dolls. One little girl in Boise, she has Krishna Balaram. She's so attached to them. Every day she spends hours decorating them and feeding them, and she'll do the whole morning program, the Mangal Arati, and then she'll do the Shingar Arati, and she'll call everybody in the community to come and see her deities dressed up, and she'll do the Arati, and you know, she's only 3 years old, so her mother won't give the flame, and then she'll distribute prasadam, she'll show them the mirror. She does everything because she copies everything in the temple. And then she'll come in the temple and she'll watch, oh, Krishna has that turban cover today. And he's got this peacock feather like that. So, and her mother will take her every week for shopping for deity things instead of toys. So that becomes her exciting time is, you know, once a week when she can shop for her Krishna Balaram. So now she's got Gornithai deities. So these things are a very nice way of spending time with the children. Because it's not only beneficial for them, but also for us. Just by doing this for over the years, I became very attached to deities, you know. So it's very good for us also. So we go to the next part, the books of the basis.
So this second section deals more with the academic side of homeschooling. And the curriculum and what to emphasize in the curriculum, and specifically looking at developing an education system based on Srila Prabhupada's books.
So initially, my children went to school for 2 years, and then I was totally dissatisfied and then pulled them out. And I was very, very nervous because, like most of us here, you know, we are always so worried about the academic side of our, you know, education for our children. And we don't want to, dilute that part. So I subscribed to a curriculum, you know. I bought a curriculum. In America, homeschooling is a big thing now, and you can actually buy a curriculum that for a whole year. And of course, you know, it just lasted for a couple of months, and I threw it out because, you know, whatever. There were so many things in the subject matter that was not Krishna conscious, and I was constantly trying to substitute them, and it didn't work. So that's when I decided that I have to go all out and try Prabhupada's, you know, books as a main curriculum. So what I did was, for the first 12 years of their life, I just concentrated on these 5 R's, as you can see. Reading, writing, arithmetic, rote, and raga. Because children who are, you know, if they have a good foundation of reading, especially reading, they can actually study any subject matter, any subject. Because if their language arts and comprehension is very good, then naturally, you know, you give them any science book or you give them any book, they can understand. So Prabhupada stressed that. He said, if children learn English and Sanskrit, they become great preachers, they become, you know, more than MA and PhD, just by these two subjects. Why? Because they can read his books. And his book says everything. And particularly he mentioned about Srimad Bhagavatam. So we have some nice quotes on Srimad Bhagavatam here, and we can read that. Do you want?
The curriculum, our main focus of study during homeschooling was learning the language arts through study of Srimad Bhagavatam. And my mother will talk more about that in just a minute in terms of how to teach language arts and teach English comprehension, spelling, grammar, all those things through the study of Srila Prabhupada's books. But just as a way of getting started, here are some nice quotations from Srila Prabhupada encouraging us to take the Bhagavatam seriously and make it the foundation of education. So we can just read these together. Our students specifically... I didn't mean it that way. But you're welcome to if you like. Our students specifically, they should take care of reading Srimad Bhagavatam. We have therefore prescribed in our school, Dallas, and from the very beginning, if they begin education with Bhagavad Gita and then come to Srimad Bhagavatam and read the whole literature, then they will be more than MA, PhD. Even astronomy, astrology, politics, sociology, atomic theory, everything is there. Therefore, if we study Srimad Bhagavatam very carefully, then you will get all knowledge completely. Throughout the whole world, whatever knowledge is there is in the Srimad Bhagavatam. If one simply reads this Srimad Bhagavatam, his education is the topmost. If one studies Srimad Bhagavatam, he is well versed in every subject matter. So studying Srimad Bhagavatam brings with it so many different benefits. Sometimes we underestimate the depth of knowledge that Srila Prabhupada has given us in his books. In today's world, in the educational systems at the university, colleges, high schools, universities are looking for is to cultivate skills of critical thinking in their students. You see, in earlier times, education was largely based on learning information, memorization. You memorize tables, you memorize formulas, you memorize facts and figures, you memorize dates and histories. These days, that kind of memorization of information is kind of pointless, in that people are realizing getting information is not the problem of our time. Right? In fact, we live in the time of what they call the information superhighway. Right? People basically suffer from an information overload in our society, where you have so much information about every possible subject. Today, if you want to get any information on anything, you can just type it up in Google and you'll get a whole list of web pages about the tiniest village in Siberia, what the economy is like in Mongolia, anything you want, right? You can get on the internet. My students, before the first day of class, they've already typed my name into Google, Ravi Gupta, and then they say, oh, Ravi Gupta is actually Radhika Raman Das. And oh, he's a member of ISKCON, and this is what he does in his spare time. They've read everything about me beforehand, right? And they know who exactly I am. It's no point kind of introducing myself to them. You can do that practically with anything these days. Anything. We all have our electronic footprint on the internet. And every subject is available. The question now for educators is not how to get information, but how to train students, how to train children to organize that information, to decide what is relevant, and then to evaluate that information and say, this is true, this is not true. This is correct, this is not correct. This is useful, this is not useful. This is where it's applicable, this is where it's not applicable. Being able to analyze that information, digest it, and apply it properly, that's the great challenge. This is what they call critical thinking, right? Critical thinking skills, logic, argument skills. How to take that information and digest it. And this is exactly what we learn, what we get by studying the Shastras. Sometimes we might take these things for granted. We talk commonly, we're not the body, we're the spirit soul. Everyone knows that, right? Even a five-year-old can say that. We understand, Krishna has three energies, material energy, spiritual energy, marginal energy. There's three aspects of Godhead, Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. These are like common knowledge for us. But if you talk to the average person on the street, this is very, very complicated and abstract material. What we consider basic stuff is actually quite advanced. I remember the first time I was at an academic conference and there was someone there from a different religious tradition. He was also a graduate student. I was a graduate student at that time. And he said, tell me something about your religion. And so I started off kind of with the basics. We believe we're not the material body, we're the spirit soul. And all the labels that we put on this body, I'm black, I'm white, I'm American, I'm Indian, I'm beautiful, I'm ugly, all these labels are actually just labels on the body. They don't connect to who we are, the spirit soul. And I remember he just looked at me with like amazement and he said, "Wow, that's deep. That's really deep, you know?" And I thought, I was surprised. It was the first time I kind of stopped and realized, wow, I don't realize how deep this philosophy is. Right? We take it for granted. Even a five-year-old in our movement can give the basics about I'm not the body. Right? But this is considered really abstract thought, really abstract philosophy. What to speak of when you get into the details of our philosophy. It's quite sophisticated, actually. So on the level of sophisticated thinking, philosophical thinking, on the level of language, Prabhupada's command of the English language was phenomenal. Right? He uses words in ways that we don't use anymore. Right? He knows multiple meanings of words. Often he would look for a precise word with his disciples, and the disciples wouldn't be able to come up with it. And then he'd finally come up with them. This happened to us when he says, "This material world is." There's one morning walk conversation where he's saying, "This material world, it's a pan," and he's saying, "What's the word pan?" And no one can come up with it. And then he says, "Pandemonium. This material world is pandemonium." And everyone had to go home and look up the word in the dictionary. You know, what is pandemonium? There's so many words, advanced words that are there. I remember one, my parents ran Govinda's restaurant for about 6 years in Boise. And some of our best homeschooling years were during that time. And I remember we'd be studying in the restaurant, and then customers come and we'd introduce them to the food and so forth. And sometimes they'd get interested in the motivation, the philosophy behind the restaurant. So there was two ladies who had come in, and I was explaining some items about our philosophy to them, just kind of the usual. And at some point, one of the ladies, she looked at the other one and she said, "Wow, his vocabulary. Did you hear that? Transcendental, ecstatic." These are difficult words. The average person doesn't know what ecstatic means. They, you know, ecstasy, they might know it's some kind of a drug people take. But what it actually means, no one knows. Transcendent, people don't know. Right? So vocabulary increases so well. Comprehension, analysis, logical thinking skills, debate and argument. Those, Prabhupada actively cultivated them in his disciples. And in his purports, he offers such sharp arguments back and forth for all kinds of different viewpoints from scientists, philosophers that he's arguing against. So all these things get developed just by study of Srila Prabhupada's books. And I remember when I first entered the university, I was quite young when I went to the university. I was 13 years old when I started. And I was really nervous because I was so much younger than the other students. And, I wasn't familiar with the material. The first course I signed up for was an English writing course. It happened to be a second semester honors level writing course because all the entry-level courses were full. By the time I got to register, all the basic courses were full. So the chair of the department said, "Okay, you can register for a higher-level course." So all these students were so much older than I was. It was an honors-level writing course. And then when I looked at the syllabus, it was full of classical literature. We were reading Shakespeare's Hamlet, the Odyssey and the Iliad by Homer, the Greek poet. Some classical works by Mexican Chicano writers, and like that, classical pieces of literature. And I had never studied this stuff before. Most of these students had come studying them through high school. And I was really nervous. Oh, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? But when we started writing essays and papers about this, class discussions, the teacher, she was so impressed. She said, it's really impressive. Where do you find these kinds of insights in these books? the Odyssey was, the whole atmosphere of the Odyssey was very similar to the stories of the Mahabharata. Right? So it's like epic heroes fighting in battle, and I wrote essays about Kshatriya spirit and what that means and how that's reflected in their behavior. And they're like, wow, this is really cool. This is, you're seeing insights in the book. It's, you're not just writing about the story itself. And then Shakespeare's Hamlet. The story of Shakespeare, of Hamlet and his dilemmas, is very similar to the dilemma that Arjun was going through. Hamlet's situation and Arjun's situation. Very similar. You know, Hamlet says, to be or not to be, that is the question. He's totally confused. Should I stay here and try to claim the kingdom? Should I leave? Should I go away? In order to stay here and claim the kingdom, I'm going to have to fight with my relatives. In the end, he had to fight and kill his relatives also. A very similar situation. The only difference was Arjun had the benefit of Krishna's advice, right? And Hamlet didn't. But nevertheless, the whole mood, his whole psychology, was something that was very familiar. We were used to analyzing it when we studied Arjuna's psychology in Bhagavad Gita, first chapter. So all these things came very naturally. And the point is that we should never underestimate what Srila Prabhupada gave us in his books. It's really the highest class of literature in the world. And spiritually, of course, it's the topmost. Yeah. Reading Srimad Bhagavatam can make one into a pure devotee of the Lord. But just academically speaking, it's also right up there with any kind of graduate or postgraduate literature in terms of the language, in terms of the skills necessary, and the skills that develop as a result of studying it.
I'll just talk a little bit about how I taught them Srimad Bhagavatam. When the children, Radhika was, I think, 7 years old and Gopal was five, I started reading from, by then they knew how to read fluently. And so I started reading out translations with them. I picked out the stories that would interest them because they are children. And so stories that were more, you know, with children, heroes that were children like Prahlad, Dhruva Maharaj, Gajendra story, animal stories like that. They would, you know, that would be interesting for them. So we would sit in a circle and we would read the translations only. Because obviously they would not, their attention span would, you know, would not allow them to go through long purports. And we would, I would frequently stop for discussion many, many times. In other words, I would, you know, I would put out questions to them. I would, you know, we would play the devil's advocate. They would ask, you know, questions and related to practical life situation. So by doing that, you know, their interest in the story was not just, you know, like you would read a story, like, you know, you buy a storybook and read a story, but it was more than that. And we could, their interest could sustain for quite a long time. And sometimes we would spend like 3 hours in the morning just reading Srimad Bhagavatam. And they were so young. And that happened because of the constant discussion and constant, you know, challenging. And very soon, early in their life, they learned to reason and to think and to analyze, you know, like that. So, you know, and people are quite surprised. They said, you must have done something, you know, else or whatever. Writing came much, much later. I remember that mostly it would be reading and discussion. And then once in a while, I would sit down and, you know, give them a writing assignment. And as they got older, I gave them more assignments. But basically, it was just reading and discussion. And it really helps because, you know, nowadays we are bombarded with so many philosophies and so many challenges, right? Our children go to school and they learn all kinds of things, you know, impersonalist ideas and atheistic things. And unless we, encourage them to read these books, they'll have so many doubts. They won't really be able to argue and well with their, you know, friends or teachers or whatever. And pretty soon we'll see that we lose them. So, and like Radhika said, you know, there's so much of that in Prabhupada's purports, so much of that. You know, just, yeah, in the beginning we were reading translations, and as they asked, and as they became more maturer, then they had deeper questions, and so we would have to go to the purports. Then we were, you know, we automatically went to the purports, and I would sometimes pick out the right purports for them, and we would read the purports, and as they, you know, and obviously then the, you know, they could get into more deep philosophical thinking. So Prabhupada, you know, he was always challenging, you know, his disciples to think, you know, deeper about things like that, about, you know, so many times, you know, people accuse that we are isolating our children, you know, that we are denying them all that happens in school, you know, all the things that the other children learn. And it's absolutely not true. We are not isolating our children. I tell them that, no, we are insulating our children. You know, we are insulating them from all the nonsense, you know. Because we are giving them a choice. We are giving them two sides rather than one side. The people out there, they're just giving them one side, you know. They're talking just about the material body and, you know, what it takes to make us as comfortable and happy. Whereas we are telling them the advantages, you know, of the disadvantages of a materialistic life. But we're also giving them an alternative, a good spiritual life, and a chance to go back to Godhead, right? So over there, there's violence and sex and drugs and all those things. And so through the Shastras, we're telling them the dangers of all that, but we're also telling them the benefits of celibacy. So in other words, this whole training is to train children to be, you know, good brahmacharyas, you know, and thereby they can become good grihasthas. So it's very, very valuable, this reading from Srila Prabhupada's books and understanding in this way, his books are meant for the scientific mind, you know, for today's questioning mind, because children are not going to take anything lying down anymore. If you tell them something, they're not going to accept it. We have to take shelter of Prabhupada's books for them to be able to argue and to be able to defeat these philosophies. And that's only found in Srila Prabhupada's books. It's not possible to get it anywhere else. Yes.
Transcendental and other things were there in the book. She just couldn't understand what my mother reads. How am I going to apply it to my practical life? Because she was making me read one of the essays which she had written in school. So when I read the essay and I applauded her, I said, "Your essay is very good. But now look, if you're going to read these books with me and you're going to see these big, big words, and as and when you don't understand, we will share these words, we will go to the dictionary, understand it, then you will be able to improve your language capacity and you'll be able to write better books." Like, there was a word, seldom. It's a simple word, but she found it very interesting. You know, now she's going to pick up a new word called seldom. So then she was asking me sentences, "Mom, how am I going to use seldom?" And seldom was in one of the books of Prabhupada, which recently I got in one of the small, you know, courses that I had done. But now I want to understand that which are the initial books which I can make my children read. Like, now one is going to the 6th, one would be in the 10th, for making them get attracted to, you know, the way of a Krishna consciousness life.
Most
parents also have that.
Well, what we did was Srimad Bhagavatam. Because Bhagavatam is easier for children because it's philosophy in the form of stories. See, you can also do a little bit of Bhagavad Gita, you know, but, you know, children are more attracted to stories and they can keep going for a longer time.
So
you
we
know?
Can start with the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam.
Well, you know, you can just even pick out the stories like Dhruva, Maharaj, Prahlad, Maharaj, you know, just children's stories where the heroes are children, you know.
Okay.
And gradually, you know, they will... they can go, then you can go on to more deeper things. You know, eventually, my children and myself, we finished the entire Srimad Bhagavatam all the way with purpose till the 10th canto. But that comes later, you know. But in the beginning, you can just pick out the stories, you know, that they like to hear. Like Gajendra's story and the crocodile is so fascinating for them.
Okay.
You know.
Thank you.
Yeah. And when they're very young, then they might not have so much of a stamina to read those translations, so they can read a little bit as much as they can, and then the parents can read to the children, and that also is very nice. But it doesn't take too long to pick up that reading, and to even manage the difficult words. We have in the temple one family, the same one my mother was talking about. She has 4 children, and the young girl, she was reading. She would sit in morning Bhagavatam class and she would read the purport by the time she was about 5 or 6 years old. And she was able to do it, and she felt really happy and a great sense of accomplishment. Of course, she didn't have a lot of stamina. She couldn't read a lot, but she could read something, and it developed a taste for her. And other times, her parents or her mother or her older siblings would read to her. So the process can get started quite early in terms of reading Bhagavatam. And in the beginning, okay, not so much stamina. They can read a little, and other books can be substituted. Other Krishna conscious children's books. At that time, when my mother was homeschooling us, there were actually very few out there on the market. But now you can find quite a few children's reading books available on the internet and so forth.
In terms of questions? So should does everybody need a little break here, or questions, or just questions? Okay. Any questions? Yes. In terms of purports, you can pick out ahead of time before you sit down with the children, you know, which might be relevant. But if your children are very small, you know, you can just do the translations. And, you know, as you're reading them, then it's just, the questions just come up. In other words, I didn't have the time to do too many preparatory lessons, but they're just common sense questions, you know.
But would you go in a particular order, like you're doing fifth chapter of, say, second canto, or you complete that chapter and like well, that, you know, or would you at random pick up whatever catches?
No, if I'm starting Dhruva Maharaj, then I would finish the whole thing. You know, before I went to another story like Prahlad Maharaj, you know. So, it would just go. You would want to finish one story before you'd go to another one.
And I didn't attend a pending session in the school yesterday, but at the back of, I got the printouts. Like, there was a list of questions depending on that canto, which. So would you go that way, like after a particular chapter is over, you would give the questions to the children and ask them to answer?
But the thing is that if they're already going to school, then, you know, to make it like a study like that might be too much for them. You know, because the whole idea is that you have to make it a positive experience. So if you give too much writing work and they already have so much writing work from school, then it becomes too much of a burden for them.
Those questions are actually more meant to give the parents some guidelines as to what points of discussion you might raise while reading it. And that was the most memorable part of the experience, was my mother was constantly discussing. We often had so many questions, you know, like, oh, Dhruva Maharaj, why, what does it feel like to be rejected by your father like that? Right? Why doesn't his mother do anything to help him? Why does he just say, go to the Supreme Lord? Why does Dhruva Maharaj not accept the instruction of his spiritual master, Narada Muni, when Narada Muni says, give up your desires and go back home? Right? Why does he reject that? So many questions come up, and we would just keep reading, translating, and then we discuss all these questions. So it's just a matter of actually more those are questions are kind of meant as to get one started. But basically, once you get started, you just get a sense of how to keep the discussion going in terms of what are interesting things. And half the time, the children themselves come up with questions, which then you discuss together. And what would happen in terms of the purports is that often we'd come up with a question that we didn't know the answer to. We couldn't figure it out. And so we naturally said, well, why don't we look at the purport and see what Prabhupada says? And almost always, that question was answered right in the purport. All of you must have this experience to some extent. That when you read Prabhupada's books, it's like Prabhupada anticipates the question you're going to have. And the answer to your question is right there in that purport or in the next purport. Somewhere around that area, Prabhupada always answers it. So we often found that, and it was like, wow, this is really nice. So we became more attracted to reading the purports. It kind of developed like that naturally. No, it was just translations. Yeah, that moves much faster, and it keeps the story interesting. And that's why, in terms of order, we might start someplace at an interesting story, but after that, we didn't want to stop. Like, we didn't want to skip, because everything in Bhagavatam, one thing flows into another. Everything's tied together. So you read one story that leads into the next, so you can't stop. Then you have to lead to the next, and, you know, like that. So translations keep things moving a little bit more fast, so that things don't slow down a little bit, and that becomes a little difficult for children. Can go a little slower. The questions that Mataji was referring to, those all of you will get in a handout. There's a packet here that the devotees have made, and it has a printout of all the slides that you're seeing here, along with a few two sample chapters of questions that one can use for discussion. One from the story of Dhruva Maharaj and one from the story of Prahlad Maharaj.
So sometimes as parents, we feel that, we're not qualified. I mean, I don't know enough, and how will I do this? And, but when I started doing it, then, as I read Prabhupada's books, I realized that actually I can do it. I felt more determined that this is how I want to tell my children. I got so inspired. I mean, these books are very potent. They're very powerful. So in other words, whatever we lack, Krishna is going to give us while we read these books. So in the beginning, we teach them and we share realizations. And, my main purpose of reading with them was to make sure they understood this, the Vedic perspective of everything, to establish the Vedic superiority of everything. And that much we can do just by reading it, So we should not be afraid of doing this. And eventually, as the children get better and better, then they take the lead. Now they become better than you, So it's only initially this problem is there, this fear is there. I don't know if I can do it, if I can do it, But Krishna gives, we have to pray to Prabhupada to guide us, because he's there in his books. And whatever we are lacking, he's going to fulfill it. If he's promising that everything is there, it's there. Okay, so if you just have that, begin with a little bit of faith, it's going to develop and flower. So just want to say that. Okay.
Many Matajis had this question that how did you manage your time? Because deity worship and reading Bhagavatam for some hours and housework and also managing your own sadhana, how did you manage cooking? And also as the children grow older, initially maybe just reading Bhagavatam with them or getting some work done may be enough. But as they grow older, they will actually have to start studying. Right. At some time, there might be some competitive exam that they have to appear for in order to go for further studies. Mm-hmm. So at that time, what did you do? Because when they are small, okay, maybe just reading Bhagavatam or reading small books to improve their learning abilities might be enough. But as they grow older, at some point in time, you must have started with formal education. Mm-hmm. So at that time, how did you go about it? Did you do it yourself? You engaged tutors or what exactly was done? And another question I had was, you also mentioned that wherever you went, you took your children with you and they were always with you. But sometimes when we are doing certain services like counseling, etc., we might be discussing topics that we wouldn't want the children to hear because it might not be good for them or it might make them mature ahead of time. They lose their sort of innocence when they hear adults. Sometimes it's our experience when children are too much around adults, they lose their innocence. They start talking like adults or they become extra smart or presumptuous sometimes in their talk. So how did you deal with this situation?
Yes, you also have your social life.
Well, in Krishna consciousness, the social life of children and adults are the same. So, I did have a social life, but obviously it all was centered around the temple. And like I said earlier in my seminar, yeah, we have a separate, so we'll talk about that. But let me answer her question.
Yeah, and one more related is that sometimes, our children have got devotee friends.
Yeah.
Like, for example, my teenage daughter has many friends in the temple. Mm-hmm. So now their coming to a temple is largely based on whether the friends come or not.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to bring them everywhere, we want to take them everywhere. But sometimes they already know who's coming, who's not coming. So they say, I don't want to come.
Mm.
So, what do we do? I mean, you don't go, you don't do the service, or you insist that they should come, become a tiger, as you said, when she happens to be here right now. But I'm just asking, because sometimes we may want the kids to come be with us all the time. We may not mind them being around, but they have other interests. Maybe your children must be special, but sometimes our children don't want to do what we are doing.
Mm-hmm.
They want to do something different. It's always Krishna conscious. It's not something bad, but sometimes they want to do something different. They don't want to do what we are doing. They want to be separate. So then how do you deal with?
Yes. Your first question about time, you know, it's a struggle. Obviously, it's not easy when we have so many things to do. You know, we have our own, you know, sadhana and cooking and all that. You know, it's a juggle. You know, it's a balancing act that we have to do where we set priorities. You know, when I realized that I had to homeschool my children, I started thinking of how I can simplify my life immediately. I started, you know, in America, it's cold, so we have carpets. I started ripping carpets off and, you know, just having bare floor just so I can clean quicker, you know. And my kitchen, I totally redesigned the kitchen, and we, you know, we had, you know, like stainless steel tables and things like that can be, you know, we can keep clean quickly. So in other words, my housework, I tried to reduce to, you know, as minimum a time I could. Because I want to spend time cooking, but not, you know, not doing so many of other chores. So we can start thinking of how to prioritize our life. You know, what are the things that we might be doing a lot of things that are totally unnecessary and cumbersome and, you know, and too much. So simple life and high thinking like that. So once we do that, then we realize that we actually find more time to do more things. You know. So, of course, everything, when you're doing so many things, everything cannot be to its perfection. But we know what our goal is. So I would try not to compromise on the important things, even though some other things would lag behind, you see. Because we cannot be perfect like that. So. Well, you know, it is hard, you know, in terms of having sometimes a preaching center and having services in the morning. But no, during the day, there was always times you can take an extra nap, you know. Being at home is easier to do that, you know. In fact, I would always worry about my husband because he had to go to work. And if he didn't get his sleep, then, you know, it would be difficult. So he would take a nap in the car in the afternoon. We had a ways of getting around that. But, you know, the struggle itself in Krishna consciousness, even though, yeah, sometimes it could be physically tiring, but there's so much reciprocation from Krishna. It's so different than trying to do some material, you know, pursuits, which has become so frustrating, you know. So even though there was so much work and we also had a lot of sannyasis and gurus coming through and everything, we got so much nectar from them and so much inspiration from them and a lot of chastisement too. So Krishna gives us the strength to do that. If you become very, and we, if you look upon our, you know, job as a devotional activity and not something like a burden, you know, like something that's taking away our time, that's also very important for parents to think that our time spent with children is the most important time. It's not time taken away from me. Of course, if you are sick and everything, you do need extra rest and you should try to find extra help. You shouldn't run yourself down or anything like that. But mostly, you know, it's just having that kind of consciousness where we take this as a service to God. You know, we are servants of Krishna and children are also servants and we see them as servants of Krishna also. So that helps, and that consciousness helps in working hard. You know, Prabhupada writes one time when he was, trying to find a Rath Yatra cart. There's a very sweet story of how he was crying and going to every carpenter, asking them to make him a Rath Yatra cart. And then finally nobody did, and an old lady gave him an old one. And he painted it and cleaned it. And he says, "I was never lazy," he writes, you know. Even as a child, he was never lazy. And the other thing I always also, which kept me going was that I thought, well, if I don't work hard this way, I'm going to push myself and, you know, some other way. In other words, we will always kill ourselves some way or the other. Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, either I'll be a big social person trying to, you know, be socially like that or whatever. Or, you know, or work for some cause, you know, some cause that I want to work. So why not do it this way, where we are making such wonderful devotees and pleasing Krishna and Prabhupada in this way? Because one good soul can change the lives of so many others. And that was Prabhupada's dream, you know, for our for the future of this movement, you know, is that if you make these, you know, children into pure devotees, we cannot even imagine the result. But if you lose, he said, even one Vaishnava, it's a very big loss. So, what was your third question, Mataji? Yes. As teenagers. Prabhupada, pure association is important because children need to play and, you know, with the children of their own age. But Prabhupada gave precedence to adult association more. He said, good adult association is more important than whole hours and hours of pure association. Because he said, you know, if we have only so much intelligence and we are constantly with other children who also have very little intelligence, then we won't learn much. So in other words, we do give them peer association, but not at the cost of good adult association. Okay. So in terms of, presumptuousness, I basically never, by teaching them through the Bhagavatam, you know, children become very, very mature. Very mature. Their maturity level is so quick, and that's why they got, getting into college, by the way, was just an accident. It wasn't anything planned for, and I don't recommend that to anybody. It just so happened. And the one thing that was very, very scary was this to other people, and to me also, was the emotional part, you know, whether they were going to be able to cope emotionally with all the other people. And that was my, my biggest surprise is that, yes, by reading Prabhupada's books and by being a devotee, you know, our emotional maturity is very, very on par with adults. Because Prabhupada said, you know, in Srimad Bhagavatam, you can understand every psychological situation in the world. Look at the stories that are there and the kind of psychology we are dealing with, you know, over there. So, you know, I had, my life was an open book with my children. There was nothing that I had to hide from them. You know, of course, there were limits on certain subject matters, but basically, you know. Do you want to talk?
On the limited subject matters, it was the basic explanation that my mother would give is, this is not something suitable for brahmacharis. And we always had this spirit that, we're brahmacharis, we want to be brahmacharis. And so she would just say, this is not suitable for brahmacharis. So this part is, you know, so like in the temple activities or the temple was kind of, it was small. So it was like a preaching center, almost similar maybe to a counseling group here. I'm not sure exactly how they work, but I think the size may be quite similar in terms of the beginnings of the temple we were in. And whenever there was some kind of a conversation in relation to two devotees, or they had some issue, or there was some issue with the management, which was us basically, then there would always be discussion in the house, and my parents would be quite open about the discussion. If there was some particular issue which was not suitable, you know, some grihastha couple was having trouble following one of the regulative principles, and they'd come to my parents for advice. Then at that point, they would say, this subject is not suitable for brahmacharis, you know. So we'd have a basic idea, okay, this is something in that realm, but it's not for me, right? I'm trying to be a brahmachari. And that was okay. That was sufficient like that. In terms of your question on the Bhagavatam, the basic point of what we're saying here is that the Bhagavatam, study of Bhagavatam was not simply the reading of stories for children at an early age. The Bhagavatam study, in fact, really became important when we grew older. It was really, we shouldn't think that this is talking about just the early years and how to keep children engaged with stories, because the real Bhagavatam study began at an older age. It was the major part of our curriculum. So in terms of all the language arts, it was basically covered through this. In terms of other subjects, that's something that's coming up just after this, in terms of what other subjects my parents would cover and how. But in terms of all things related to the language arts, it was all through Prabhupada's books.
in terms of time between father and mother, can you just explain us how much father would spend the time or how much a mother would spend the time? Please. clear a lot of doubts between father. why so much of commotion? No, I just saw none.
So the majority of the homeschooling was obviously done by my mother. She was.
Samira is for mothers.
but my father had a very, very important role to play. we would often spend time with him in the evening, especially when he came back from work. He would help us at times on subjects like mathematics or studying Hindi with him or other areas in which he particularly was good at and wanted to help. He would spend a lot of time with us in our free time and weekends and so forth doing activities together. Especially we learned a lot of things such as working around the temple, doing like practical projects, working with tools, things like that, just things that had to do with beyond the academic subjects themselves through my father a lot. And especially at the time when my parents were running Govinda's restaurant. We had a family-run Govinda's in Boise for 6 years. And at that time, it was run by my parents. My mother was doing the bulk of the work because my father was at work all day, and then he would take over in the evenings when he came and on the weekends as well. And that was a lot of work. It was one of the most intense periods for our family. But it was also one of the nicest periods I remember in all through my homeschooling because it was so dynamic. We got to meet with customers, we got to talk to people, we got to preach, we would introduce the food to them, explain what everything is. We learned about accounting and how to run the cash register. We learned how to cook and how to do things in a big kitchen. And we did tons of dishwashing and cleaning tables. And so it was kind of a very kind of well-rounded experience, which really made homeschooling very, very full. One of the questions that we had here was in terms of social life. The point is homeschooling is not just studying books, right? If we think of homeschooling as simply reading books, then yes, homeschooling can be a very, very boring, very depressing activity. But the point is just like any kind of educational system, it needs to be well balanced, right? Parents have to make sure that the homeschooling is an academically rigorous educational method, but also it has to be fulfilling in other ways, socially, in terms of other life skills, in terms of interacting with the wider public. And there are many ways of doing that, which we'll discuss a little bit later.
Haribol? Prabhuji, could you throw some light on the difference between the teaching methodology between you and your brother? Since you went in for education in further studies based on religion, whereas your brother did a science and religion thing he is pursuing right now. So to inculcate a scientific attitude and aptitude at a young age, you would have to be exposed to a proper, you know, a lab kind of situation or experimental basis and that kind of thing. So would that be possible in a homeschooling kind of situation? Because each child has a different interest. You know, some children are very inclined towards a scientific study.
Right. Yeah, my brother, he did a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering, and then he did an M.Tech in electrical engineering, and then he's now going on to do a PhD in science and religion, looking at their combination. So our lines were very different, but our curriculum was pretty much the same. We both studied the same things. We both studied Srimad Bhagavatam together. I chose to go in a humanities side, studying Sanskrit and religion. My brothers chose to go in a scientific side. But the skills that are necessary for both in terms of critical thinking, logic, argument, those are basically the same. At an early age, laboratories tend to be very simple homemade experiments, and we can do those at home with the children. As the children grow older, it may be necessary to have more of a lab experience, as you were saying. And so for some time, we had a tutor. My parents hired a tutor who basically we would go to in order to do the laboratory work. He had a whole lab on the ground floor of his house, and many homeschooling parents would come to have their children use the laboratory, basically. That's another way of doing it. Homeschooling often works very well in cooperatives, four or five families doing homeschooling together. Because what happens is maybe one mother is really into the science side, and they want to take the initiative to build a little laboratory. And then the other students can come there once a week to use the laboratory. Whereas another mother might be really into taking out field trips and going and visiting places. And the children can go with her on a field trip every couple of weeks or something like that. You see what I mean? So everyone has their own interest. And that's why working in a group is very nice. And in some sense, the system here at ISKCON Chaupati is very nicely set up in terms of the counselor system, where already the community is kind of centered in small-knit groups. And so a few families working together in a homeschool cooperative works beautifully because it takes care of many of the social concerns that people have in terms of homeschooling. Or what peer association will they get? How will they play with each other? What kind of interaction will they have? Right? In fact, should we just go to the social life slide? Yeah, because we've discussed a lot of that anyway. Yeah.
Just, you know, I think I was just determined to make them into nice devotees. That's all. I mean, yeah. Okay. I remember when I was homeschooling, I was constantly talking to them. I talked and I talked and I talked. I felt like that was education for them. Because, you know, this is how children learn, right? Prabhupada talks about that, how, you know, for a child, his father is his authority. You know, he asks, what is this father? And he says, this is a pen, you know. So that's authority. And the parents can never cheat the child. So that becomes perfect authority, right? And then later on, we understand the Vedic authority. So like that, you know, for children, we are perfect authority. So if you're talking to them, if you're devotees, and we're constantly talking to them all the time, then that would be very good education for them. So I would answer their questions, just like what you're talking about, the patience part. You know, if they ask questions, just answer them, but always answer them from a Krishna conscious perspective. Always be talking about Krishna, and then you get the patience, you see? The patient. Yeah. So you have to read. You know, maybe every day, 15 minutes before you go to bed, read some book. You know, read Science of Self-Realization. Some nice chapters there. But so many questions I answer. Yeah. Yeah. So you have to challenge them. You have to destroy those that kind of thinking with a Vedic perspective. And to do that, you have to read with them, and you can also try to read on your own. You see, and then you will have the answers, and then you will have the patience. We get frustrated because we don't know how to answer them. You see, isn't it? So yeah, we may be new devotees right now, and we might get frustrated. But as you take Prabhupada's formula seriously. Of practical devotional life and reading. Prabhupada said, I've written my books not just to sit on the shelves. I mean, they should be read, you know. So we should take that part seriously. I really sincerely believe that because, you know, unless we do that, we really cannot, you know, challenge them. We cannot answer them. We won't have the confidence to give them this identity, you know. You know, they will have doubts and we won't be able to answer those doubts. Okay. you know, sometimes we don't have the time. We don't have the time in the day where we can sit by on our own for 2 or 3 hours and train, you know, and read on our own. So that was my problem. I never had the time, you know. So whatever I read with them. But see, they, even though we are reading with them, but because we are older, we are, and we are more mature, our understanding is deeper, you see, just because of our life's experiences. So we still become fit to teach them, you see. So, I mean, if we have an impractical schedule where we are trying to do so many things, you know, on our own, we'll get frustrated and the children will become a burden for us. But if you do it alongside with them, because, you know, I remember, you know, I did Sunday school for so many years and I used to enjoy that so much. I learned so much about Krishna just through Krishna stories, you know. You know, it's not like, you know, so any service we do with children, we are advancing. We are making spiritual advancement very quickly, you see.
Did you have a very structured curriculum once you had when you started the schooling for both the sons? But would you recommend a similar curriculum to the devotees now? Or would you like them to discover themselves through the structured curriculum depending on their capability and the ability of the
Yes, I'm sharing my experience, you know, my way of teaching. But definitely everybody can adjust and adapt according to their particular situation and the children, you know, and the age group of the children. But the general principle is the same. In other words, it's nice to study Srila Prabhupada's books as the main part of the curriculum, because I feel like so much time is being wasted during these crucial years of their life in trying to bring so many books in and wasting the time in studying so much, because children won't remember anything. So all these years when we teach them, and they have such huge bags with so many books, everything goes out from the, you know, everything. They don't remember anything. So if we can save these years and teach them from, you know, these such advanced books, then later on when they have to go to school, you can just start a year ahead, year early, and then start with the 10th grade, you know. That's when they need to get official school, right? So you just start a little 1 year early and start teaching them those subjects. You may even get tutors, you know, because we may not have that capability of teaching them those subjects, the advanced level, right? But you'll notice that because you've been training them, you know, to do independent thinking through Bhagavatam, they actually will surprise you. And they will be able, even at that age when they are in 10th grade, they will be able to handle those subjects with just an overall guidance from you. Because they've learned the skills of studying, you know, the study skills. So you're teaching them the tools, you know, how to study independently, how to think, you know, how to be motivated. And once you've done that, then in later part of their life, they can actually do very well, you know. But to waste the first 10 years of their life, you know, or 15 years of their life, you know, just in all these mundane subjects, you know, which they're going to learn anyway in college. It's not like if you teach them from day one, from 5 years old, if you teach them all these subjects, that they're going to do better when they get in college, that they're going to get in IIT better. No. In fact, it's the other way around. If you train them in all these nice shastras, their brain will be so sharp and so clean. You know, when our brain is clean, you know, free of all the clutter, then we can soak in anything we want to. You see? So I feel too much time is being wasted in, you know, and that's why homeschooling becomes such a good option for children. Okay, Hare
Krishna. Hare Krishna. Yes. Mataji.
Yes.
Question. One question is about you know, the fact that large proportion of our children are going to Gopal's Garden High School, which I think you visited, which is a fairly Krishna conscious school. Mm-hmm. It is providing the standard material education, but in a very Krishna conscious environment.
Yes.
With lot of children who are also Krishna conscious, and also in fact brahmacharis also come there, so they're receiving, I would say, a fair dose of Krishna consciousness in, you know, in their you know, education. The question is that in that situation, How do you propose that we supplement, you know, for the remaining hours of the day, whatever they have, how do we supplement, you know, Krishna consciousness? That's question one. And question two is, you know, like to Radhika Raman Prabhu, that, you know, when you were doing homeschooling, now, how do you reconcile the time where you spend in the evening, suppose? In the evenings, I presume you would be playing with, you know, your neighbors or whoever, whatever, playing some games, physical games and so on and so forth. So, is that where you develop the ability to kind of, you know, play with, mix with other people, or how does it work? So
we're going to get to the social skills, right? So to answer your first question regarding, you know, how can you supplement the curriculum that's, you know, available there already, I talked to the principal and she said she was very soon going to introduce a Vedic curriculum very soon. So the children will be taught specifically, you know, some Shastra every day. And we talked a lot about that, you know, about different things. So, you know, you have to see how much, how the child, when he comes home, because I know for a lot of people it's a long commute, right? So by the time the child comes home, he's tired. You know, you don't want to put more burden on, you know, of, you know, studying, you know. So I think a nice way to spend time after he comes home is some chanting, you know, some music, chanting and light things like that, you know, because that's very important part of a family activity is to spend time in the evening chanting and a little bit of reading together, you know, some joyful time like that. Yeah.
Nandanandan from the Goshala in Vrindavan. He was 14 years a brahmachari in one of the Gaudiya Mass, and he used to come with 14 years to see Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada loved him very much. He plays wonderful harmonium. He's very knowledgeable in the Shastra. A very simple person, though. You will never know that he is actually very intelligent, you know, philosophically and like that. And he has four girls, and they're taking care of the Goshala in Vrindavan. And in the evenings, they're spending their time regularly to have aartik. And being Bengali, they have all these wonderful Vaishnav songs, Narottam Das Thakur, etc. And they're singing with so much bhav because they understand also. And all the girls, they're playing some instrument. One plays the madranga and the tablas. The other one plays harmonium, yeah. And the other play the little ones play the kartals. But they have every evening an aarti, yes. Sandhya aarti for Gornitai, and later on they used to have it over the loudspeaker and the whole community. It was transmitted to the MVT, like that. So. He's great inspiration also in terms of training the girls, you know.
Yeah, that's a very nice comment, because Krishna consciousness needs to be fun for the children, a very, very pleasing thing, something they enjoy doing. So the music and things like that is a very important part of their life. And it needs to be cultivated, like, you know, Mother Nautaki is saying, you know. So it's important to teach them different instruments and chant together as a family. You know, my younger son was very musically inclined. Radhika was more philosophically inclined. So he found his interest in music, and I would encourage him through that. I actually wanted to educate him through his interest in music. And the way we did it was, instead of writing articles or like Radhika did, he would write scripts because he loved drama and acting. He was playful, you know. So he would write scripts. So that became a big part of his education. I mean, writing scripts is not an easy thing, you know. You have to study the story. You have to, you know, organize it, write it, edit it. So, you know, like that. And then his music interest also was very beneficial, because he would love to sing Narottam Das Thakur's songs. And there's so much philosophy in those songs. If you know those books, you know, he learned all his philosophy through songs. So whatever the child's interest is, one can dovetail it into good education. And we did that very practically through festivals. You know, should we go to festivals? Yeah, since we're talking. So a lot of our homeschooling, like Radhika was saying earlier, didn't just come through books. Was through music, through festivals, through, celebrating festivals. Because that became a very good avenue for me to educate them also. You know, when we had big festivals like Janmashtami or Gaur Purnima, we would take 2 weeks off. And we would just dovetail our teaching into, preparing for the festival. By reading about the festival, about, Krishna or Lord Chaitanya, and then we would, I would give them assignments, and then we would prepare for that festival in so many different ways. You know, they would help out with organizing, cleaning, decorating, and they would practice so much music, the kirtan that we would be performing during that time. So these are, like Mother Nataka is saying, these are very, very important part of lifestyle of for a child, so that he can see Krishna consciousness as really something pleasing. I mean, that's what Krishna did in Vrindavan, right? All the time, the whole mood in Vrindavan was a festival. I mean, constantly the residents of Vrindavan were dressing themselves up, and and Krishna was celebrating all kinds of festivals, Gopashtami and Chandan Yatra and all these things. Vrindavan is like one festival. Every day is a festival. And Prabhupada writes about that the main business of a householder is to do deity worship and observe festivals. And observing festivals means, inviting people to your homes, sharing prasadam with them, and children learn so much out of that. I mean, it's such a joyous occasion. I mean, when children celebrate festivals, those experiences of Krishna consciousness deeply embedded in their hearts. They never forget them. And it stays with them all their life. Some of the things in my own childhood that I remember best are those festivals. Like the Shera, Diwali and all those things, So we have to make sure, if we are living far away from the temple, we have to observe them at home. Do everything that Prabhupada asked us to do. Cook and make an offering, decorate the altar. My husband was very big on observing festivals. He would insist on a collective family effort. And he would, he would have us open our homes to, anybody. And Prabhupada, we've read so much about how he was so keen on celebrating festivals in such a big way. This is such a nice way of preaching. And for children, it's such a nice way of educating them, on practical devotional service. Through festivals, they can show practically their love for Krishna. You see, you can read about it all in the books all day, but then when you have to practically demonstrate that, how you can show your love to Krishna, how Krishna is a person, and to develop a personal relationship with him, then you can do it through the festivals. And of course, they love all the music and the song and the sharing with their friends. They get a great chance to socialize. And of course, the study part is also taken care of. When we would even celebrate the appearance and disappearance days of acharyas. We would take a couple days off or one day off. We'd read about them in detail. We just get so absorbed in just their life story. Prabhupada writes, actually talks about it, how to celebrate festivals. And he was very keen for all of us to celebrate these appearance and disappearance days of acharyas. And he mentions how we have to read about their writings. So, and then of course the practical side of cooking an offering for them, doing pushpanjali, and these things stay in their hearts. It's very, very effective. So this is the practical side of Krishna consciousness, which also helps in, educating them nicely. Yes. In the temple? Yes, yes. I've talked to her. She's such a wonderful devotee. Yes.
Many other like Indian hospital, certain nurses I know, fantastic devotees.
Mm-hmm.
Many places.
Yeah.
And so do, I mean, do they feel that okay, I should do whatever I can do best?
Mm-hmm.
And then because I'm serving Krishna and Prabhupada, right, they would definitely take care of myself.
Yes.
Would they just think like that? Or they should still think about coming out of that responsibility and then
Well, you.
And within Mumbai, at least we have a culture because of temple that people are, you know, the mata is no okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting married, I'm supposed to be a housewife. I can do best. Many outstation preaching and many. Yeah, sadness and mata is work.
So yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
see, for most of us, we're just working outside for some extra, you know, career or money. So basically, I'm talking about that, you know, if that can, you know, if that's not necessary, if materially we are okay with one income, then there's no necessity to go out and work and, you know, and not keep our children with us, you know. That would not be a good thing. But in terms of something that Rajkumari Mataji is doing, it's a very, very important service where she's reaching out and giving a chance to so many children to get a nice environment and a Krishna conscious education. And I noticed how she was also, you know, very, very careful about raising her children nicely as well. And so we have those special, you know, situations where, you know, one has to, you know, compromise, you know, and of course early in the movement, I mean, so many mothers, you know, sacrificed in so many big way to, and, you know, to serve Srila Prabhupada, you know, at the cost of not have, you know, keeping the children with them. So, I mean, definitely those are, you know, special, special situations and cases. But in general, you know, what I'm stressing is that if possible, you know, we have to see what's, you know, priority, you know. For a lot of us, you know, services that we're doing in the temple can be adjusted. In other words, we don't have to just give up all our services, you know, but it can be adjusted in a way where we do not, you know, put any harm to our children and neglect them. We have to be very conscious of the fact, you know. Yeah. So...
Which mentions homeschooling between non-homeschooling, you had a self-curriculum or subscribe in 5 to 10 years.
Yes.
So well, I would assume you started 5 years.
Yes.
Idle age, and what do you think is an upper age for the kid to? You did mention in one of the answers that if the student reaches 9th grade, for example, and then because India, in Mumbai specifically, the schools are till the 10th grade.
Mm-hmm.
I may be preempting this question. You may have some slides on formal education. But what do you think is an upper age for a kid to be put in homeschooling?
In formal school?
Yeah. No, I mean in homeschooling.
Well, homeschooling can be done from day one. I mean, upper age.
Homeschooling is often done all the way up to entering university. So we don't know exactly what the legal situation here is in terms of students getting admission to the university. Perhaps they would have to stop homeschooling a little bit earlier. I think some of the devotees here may have done some research about the legal and the particular implications of doing homeschooling. Is there anyone here who can speak to that? Okay, so Shyanandapuru has done research about this in terms of what possibilities there are in terms of pursuing homeschooling in the Indian context and at what stage they need to go on to regular school.
I think I've heard that they have a board, special board, like not the SSC or the ICSE board. So somebody was mentioning there are about 30,000 students in Maharashtra doing homeschooling. And there's a separate board, which is not a part of the ICSE or the SSC board. So once you... NIOS board. So basically once you... National Institute of Open Schooling. So once you finish that, I think college, you need to go and start this. So it's like the 10th standard. 10th standard.
And they take like regular examinations to pass that?
No, they have a board which gives a set of papers for the 10th standard. So it's
So all that you can do through homeschooling?
Yeah, you can do
that. Achcha. And then after that, go to university? Yeah. Okay, so there is a whole system here. And you said there's 30,000 students being done. Yeah. Maharashtra only, okay.
They have other academics also in that.
Yeah. Would you like to say something about
that? I think we have discussed that. Yeah. That will be a separate discussion for this group.
Just give a little idea so it's a little, we know whether it's feasible or not. It's helpful for us also.
You are going, so therefore they should ask you.
Okay, so what we'll do then is we'll continue through our presentation. We'll hold on to the questions for a little bit longer. And let's just get through the remainder of our presentation here. And then we can take more questions after that. Okay.
Should I do writing? So now we can discuss a little bit about social skills. That's, during the seminars, that's the number one question for people. What about social skills? Because in school, children have so many other children to be with and play with. So we feel that, homeschooling kids, they get very isolated and lonely and feel left out and everything. So I think here in Chowpatty, that shouldn't be a problem because there's so many nice families and so much cooperation where we can think about a co-op, a homeschooling co-op. Actually, in Chicago, Romapa Swami is really working with his disciples and their families on making suchas as families. So it can be also done over here. And that helps with it helps the children with their social skills because they have each other to play with. They have each other to learn together. But basically, the responsibility is primarily of the parent of the child. Okay, so homeschooling means that the major responsibility is of the parents. But we can combine with other families and do things together, especially things like field trips and parties and things like that. You know, nice Krishna conscious parties. I mean. And slumber parties, my children growing up, I had a big struggle with slumber parties because we didn't have, we started a center there. There weren't any devotees, so, there was not much their peer association. So, it was difficult for me to decide where they're going to go and have a sleepover and have some fun. So I started calling the kids to my house, and I would have sleepovers in my house. So try to get around that, So I would let them associate, but when it was, when I wasn't sure about what kind of friends they were, I just kept an eye on them and made sure. So in other words, we can expose them, but we have to do it in a protected way. It's not like we isolate them from everything, but we expose them to the world outside. They're going to be exposed anyway at some point, but we give them a good foundation of Krishna consciousness. So like I said, I already talked earlier about how it's important for children to have good adult association and also good friends. Now, many times we as parents get very disturbed because they don't have enough friends. But we experienced in our own life that when my children had even one or two good friends, they were quite satisfied. In other words, even having one or two good devotee friends is better than having a host of non-devotee friends, where they're picking up all kinds of nonsense things. So sometimes we get very tight about that subject matter. We feel like, oh, they need so much of this and they need so much of that. And that comes from just our training where we want to just satisfy all the, you know, material desires. In other words, you know, they demand this and that, and we feel very guilty, you know, when we don't satisfy that. So if you give them just nice friends, nice devotee friends, then I think they can develop social skills through the temple also, help them to participate in festivals. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, there are children from the congregation in Boise who started out being so shy. The parents were just totally frustrated. They wouldn't say a word. They wouldn't talk to anybody, always shy. And then they started participating in these dramas, these festivals. And they became totally changed children. They said, I can't believe what happened, you know. So this temple is a great resource for their social skills. Just participating in different activities, volunteering work, you know, devotional work, and participating in plays. But we should encourage our children to do as much as possible. You know, joining Sunday school. And that's where parents can do some service, you know, put their children there and also do Sunday school, help out with that. So...
Do the counseling groups here meet regularly for like programs in homes and like Namahatta or Bhakti Riksha? Yeah, so something like that can be an excellent venue to get children involved and really make it a children-centered event. This is what can be done if, you know, in case like we have a big temple here, so sometimes there may not be so much opportunity for children to get directly involved in programs in such a large temple. But that same thing can be replicated in a much smaller group, either in a pre-existing counseling group or, again, if homeschoolers get together and they create some kind of a group together, then that group can be very much children-centered. In other words, the children give the classes, children lead the kirtans, you know, kind of like they do at Gopal's Garden also when they celebrate festivals. It's children-centered. The adults are there to encourage and to help and to help the children get dressed up and everything. But basically, that really makes a wonderful opportunity both to get lots of fun in terms of social groups. This was so much fun in terms of our own temple, which was, you know, like, again, small, like a preaching center. And at the same time, develop skills like public speaking and confidence in relating to people and talking to strangers, things like that can all be developed through that. But one of the most important things that develops these kinds of social skills and very important life skills, communication skills also, amongst homeschool children is engaging in preaching activities. Preaching provides when we have to explain Krishna consciousness to others, then it really develops a strong sense of identity and a confidence amongst a child. I remember that when my mother used to organize so many different programs, sometimes in elementary schools where we'd be invited to make presentation on Krishna consciousness, gradually at high schools, even colleges or universities. Sometimes there'd be a fair or carnival in town or an event at a library. And any time there was any kind of event happening or where she could get an invitation, she would organize a preaching activity for us. And in the beginning, it was mostly my mother and my father who would do most of the presentation. And we would just kind of help. We would assist them preparing the prasadam or distributing it or doing small things. But eventually, as we were observing, we could do more and more and more. And eventually, by the time we were 12 or 13, we were practically doing the programs in terms of speaking ourselves and doing the kirtan and answering questions and so forth. It develops a great sense of confidence and identity because when we have to explain Krishna consciousness to others, and you know, someone asks us, "Why are you a devotee of Krishna?" Right? And we start wondering, thinking, "Yeah, why am I a devotee of Krishna?" Right? It really strengthens one's own faith, because this is kind of a big question or a challenge for a devotee child. Is we stay devotees for most of our childhood because Krishna consciousness is what our parents do, right? And whatever belongs to the parents belongs to us. Krishna consciousness is the property of the parents, so it's also my property as well. The home is property of my parents, so I live there also. The food they eat is their property, so I eat it also. Right? So everything they do, I do also. But the question is, when will Krishna consciousness become my own property? Right? When will I make a commitment and say, no, I want to be a devotee, regardless of whether my parents are devotee or not, but because I want to be a devotee, I'm convinced about it. It's not just something I follow because my parents are. When does that conviction become my own, in other words? And for myself and my brother, preaching had a big role to play in that. Because just the very act of presenting Krishna consciousness to others reinforces our own sense of identity. We have to dig deep inside and actually see, yes, why am I a devotee? And how can I explain it best to others? It also provides a lot of positive reinforcement to develop this identity as a devotee of Krishna. Most preaching activities are very positive experiences. People really appreciate devotees and they're welcomed with open arms. Right? And this helps the children feel that, yes, it's a good thing to be a devotee of Krishna. People like it. I'll be appreciated for it. Every once in a while, there's some kind of a negative experience. People don't like it, or they laugh at you, or they make fun of it, or whatever. But that, too, it's a nice experience. It's a good experience. Because whether we're devotees or not, at some point in life, we always face people who make fun of us and think we're no good and everything. Right? That's always a... And as young people, we need to learn how to deal with that. Right? So preaching provides kind of a full-round social experience. Skills in public speaking and communication, relating with others, talking to strangers and learning how to maintain a conversation with them, and really a genuinely satisfying interactive experience. My own memories of homeschooling are almost never centered around the studying we did. Most of my memories of homeschooling are engaged in one preaching activity after another. We'd be busy preparing for something or another, some programs coming up, some festivals coming up, and we have to get ready for it. So in order to get ready for it, we'd be practicing the tunes on the harmonium to make sure we had our music down right, or we'd be studying some books to make sure we had all the right quotes and verses so we could make our presentation properly. Right? So all this study and all this preparation would be there, it would be happening, but it wouldn't seem like study because it was all focused on the upcoming event, the preaching event. Now, this process of centering homeschooling around festivals and around preaching is not actually as radical as it sounds or as far out. There are whole curriculums, homeschooling curriculums, designed in the United States, which are centered around event-oriented learning, where you pick a particular theme or a particular event that's happening and connect all your learning and all your homeschooling to that one event. Do you know what the term is specifically? Yeah. Yeah, there's different study units designed around particular events or things that are happening. Yeah. So this can be done in a Krishna conscious way as well. And preaching is a very important way of developing that social aspect.
And it's also very effective if there's a whole group of people here who want to homeschool, is to do this preaching activities collectively. In other words, going to schools, as you know, taking all your children with you and making a presentation, you know, and finding places. So it also helps in the children, you know, having that association. Now in Boise, in the beginning, we were just our family, so we had to do it like that, you know, just my children and me like that. But now we have a whole community, so we do it as part of the community. In other words, we have three or four mothers going and a few children, and they all have something to contribute. There's a little girl who does a little five-minute dance, and then, you know, they all take part in the chanting. You know, I do the, you know, we do, the parents do the explanation. So it becomes very nice. So, you know, in the beginning, you know, when I wasn't sure about, you know, how I'm going to do this, we started out with the smaller things, like, you know, going out to preschools, calling them up and saying, would you like us to share our culture with you? So that, you know, it would be very simple things that children can relate to. And as they got older, we went to elementary schools and secondary schools, and then we moved on to high schools like that. And I still remember when Radhika did it first high school, program where he had to speak for the first time, and he was so nervous, and his hands were shaking so hard that, you know, he was holding on to the podium, you know. So he made it through, and that became a very turning point in his life where he could build the confidence to, and these were high school students, you know, where you have to, you know, answer their questions, the challenges, the arguments, you know, make a nice presentation of music. So all this becomes very, very exciting, and it can be done in a group also. And it becomes very presentable where we dress nicely with, you know, the girls dress nicely with, you know, dots and saris. And so we make a very good presentation to the public, and that way the children, you know, benefit, and also the public. Yes.
If mother is educated, won't it help? It helps additionally, because some of our mothers are not educated, and they are, you know, sending their children to Gopal's garden. They are finding it tough to cope up with the English basic. So, what do you have to say about that?
Yes, I have a few families in Boise, and a similar situation like that. One of the families that I kept mentioning is, you know, who has four children. I told you she wasn't even high school educated, and her English is quite weak. And but, you know, again, she followed this formula of reading Prabhupada's books where, you know, Prabhupada becomes the instructor, basically. You know, and we are, you know, we are using the, we are basically, our own English improves. There's another family whose English was quite weak, and she started reading the Bhagavad Gita, and she became very fluent. So what I'm saying is that you can, you know, it's not so difficult. I mean, unless you're totally, you know, illiterate.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, then, yeah, then you can send, then Gopal's, yeah, the school is there. I mean, you're very fortunate you have a school here, so you can send the children to school. Yes. I mean, homeschooling may not be for everybody, you know, but in considering the situation today in society and what the children are being put through, I tell you, anything, any form of homeschooling is better than what children go through today. I'm shocked. I'm totally shocked. So I think even some form of homeschooling, even though we may not be very academically qualified, but we, you know, we are using the right tools, you know. We have one more slide on discipline. Are there any more questions or anything? Yes. Okay, let's finish the slide. Okay. During my seminars, you know, there's a lot of questions about discipline, how to discipline children, right? So Prabhupada had a very nice formula. He said, if we cultivate in the children the propensity to love Krishna, then they shall be educated to the topmost standard, and they shall do whatever you want them to do. In other words, if we cultivate in children the propensity to love Krishna, they will do whatever you say. So in other words, if we help children become Krishna conscious, there will be very few discipline problems. Discipline problems arise because children's minds are distracted. You know, they are restless, they're distracted, they're not focused. You know, there's too much of agitation, material agitation in their minds. So if you develop a Krishna conscious lifestyle for them, there will be very few behavior problems. And I went through that. You know, of course, I had two boys and they were fighting, you know, and everything, but it was not anything major that I had to, you know, that one would experience in what people tell me. So and obedience is generally there when there's love and trust between the parent and the child. In other words, if there's love and trust, then the parent automatically wants to obey because he wants to please his parents, right? We experience that, you know, when the mother is showering so much love to the child and giving so much and spending so much time, you know, working together with the child in his homework and in his Krishna conscious activities, then the child feels very grateful and it's natural for the child to want to please the parent. And when the child wants to please the parent, then there is very little problem of discipline. So Prabhupada talked about how the child should love and fear both the parents. In other words, there should be a lot of love, but at the same time, there should be strict discipline. So the two combination works very well together. So there should be training as well as love, both. So Prabhupada did not approve of forcing the children to do things or heavy punishment, because then he said that children would run away and they will rebel. But instead, he said, strictness is there. We have to, if they are naughty, we have to punish them. We have to show, you know, we have to threaten them. It's basically very superficial. We show the stick, but we don't use it, in other words. The child is threatened. He feels threatened. Okay, if I don't do this, he's afraid of the parents, but the parents do not use the stick. In other words, everything, the child should be able to obey out of just love. Because he trusts the parents and he wants to obey the parents because he wants to please the parents.
One of the things I remember the most in regard to this aspect was the profuse encouragement that my mother always gave. Anything we did, she was always there, constantly encouraging us. I remember this first time I made this presentation my mother was talking about, and I was so nervous, and I know I didn't do a very good job. But she was still there saying, oh, it was really good. You really did a good job. And, you know, you'll keep getting better and better at this. And this was, for the first time, it was terrific. And she offered so much encouragement that you always felt enthusiastic to do more. And that encouragement itself became the reward for the activity. In other words, that she never rewarded one activity by giving us something else. If you do this well, you get extra playtime. Or if you do this well, you can watch a video. Or if you do this well, I'll give you a little pocket money. That was never the case. Because that sends the message that, oh, the activity itself is not worthwhile. It's some other material reward that makes the activity worthwhile. And it cultivates this mentality that material rewards, material physical things are actually the real reward for doing good works in life, right? But in fact, for a young person, it's very natural to try to please one's superiors, one's elders. It's only superficially in society because of peer pressure and stuff that young people feel, oh, it's cool to be rebellious and to be different and to say no. But the point is, it's natural for a child to try to please the parents. And that encouragement, just the seeing the happiness in one's superiors, on one's elders. In the beginning, it's parents. Later on, it becomes the spiritual master. That in itself should be a cause for satisfaction. Yeah, this is well done. Just a pat on the back. Yeah, I really please someone as a result of that. I remember the first time I learned that other friends, it was quite common for friends to receive some pocket money for chores they did around the house. They'd do some work like wash the dishes or something like that, and the parents would give them some pocket money. Now you can spend this. And I remember the first time a friend told me that. I was like, really? You get paid for this stuff? Said, I have to work so much in the kitchen. I never get paid for anything. And for us, it was like, no, how could it be possible? I eat the food, you eat the food also. So then you have to participate in the cleaning of the kitchen along with eating the food. These things, everything comes with its sacrifice and its reward. Every activity is accompanied by both. In other words, you get nice prasadam, then along with that is some cleaning in the kitchen that has to go along with it. Right? So every activity was reinforced simply by the encouragement. This is good activity and it pleases Krishna. And she would be constantly telling us, oh, this is nice. Krishna is so pleased. Or Prabhupada is so pleased. Or this is not good. Krishna would not be happy at this. And at times she was very strict. She got angry sometimes and told us off and everything. But it was that in itself, again, was enough. Okay, she's not happy with us. We better change our behavior. Instead of using some kind of a material reward or punishment for that purpose.
we should be very careful not to spoil our children. In other words, there has to be strictness. And Prabhupada said in the first 5 years, we can be lenient to the child. But from 5 to 10, we should be more a little stricter. But from 10 to 15, we have to be strict as a tiger. And then after 16, we have to be their friends. So in other words, we have to be, you know, we cannot spoil them and just give them whatever they want, you know. So my children, you know, when I was upset with them, they knew that they had to do what I had to tell them. In other words, just a stern voice or a stern look was enough for them to obey. So that is important, because Prabhupada said without obedience, there cannot be any good management. In other words, we can manage a house where there's indisciplined children, you know, without good behavior. So that is important. You know, and you see that in now here in India, you know, how parents just spoil their children and they just let them scream and run around and without telling them anything. We face that in Boise all the time. They just run back and forth in the temple room screaming, and the parents are right there and they won't say anything to the child. So this is not good. We have to train our children to be good Vaishnavas and to behave nicely. So, you know, they give them, you know, one Prabhu was telling me 2 days ago how, you know, when he was traveling by train, children demand Coca-Cola at 8 o'clock at night, and, you know, they come in and give them and spoil them, you know. And then they are up all night, you know, running around the whole compartment and nobody can sleep. So we have to understand that, there's affection which is there and, you know, makes us weak, or we just let them. And sometimes I have parents telling me, oh, he's my only child, how can I not do this? You know, no. Only child means, you have to even be more careful. He may get spoiled. So we want them to perform austerities. We want them to, but we want them to do it in a, we want them to enjoy doing that. So we have to do it in a proper way, but we have to discipline them also. Yes. Punishment. Well, you know, I never physically beat them or anything, you know, except when they were very little, you know, with children, very little children, you can, you know, you have to slap them once in a while, you know, like that. Huh? Yeah. What age? Yeah. Do you remember slapping? I don't think I ever beat them. I don't think I ever, you know, just, I can never remember when I physically beat them. Once, yeah. Maybe once in the whole lifetime. What age he's saying?
I don't remember actually what age I was. I can remember it, so maybe it was, I don't know, 5 or something.
Yeah, maybe.
I can still feel the sting, you know.
Sometimes, you know, huh?
It was more ego sting than anything.
I also, when I was going to school for the first couple, I remember the one time the teacher punished me by putting me into a corner. They do that in America often, stand in the corner. I don't know if they use that method here, but stand in a corner. And I just remember, I remember that whole day and that scene so vividly. It was the only time I got punished in school. And it was like you're saying, more than the trouble of standing in the corner, it was just the ego sting. Every single student who came into the classroom went, oh, did you see that? Ravi's in the corner. Oh, did you see that? Ravi's in the corner. Did you see? How did he make it into the corner? It was so humiliating, the whole experience. Never repeated it again. But I remember only once in terms of my mother slapping, I think, not more than that.
But it's important that they should at least have some fear of at least one of the two parents. Because just like Prabhupada, you know, his mother was strict, but his father was lenient. Because if you have both strict parents in his heart, the child cannot run to the other one for shelter. So it's important. So, you know, my husband was a little lenient, I was a little strict. Because I had to, you know, I was with them, I had to, you know, homeschool them, train them. But there was always that element of love in that. You know, they knew that, you know, I would go beyond my, you know, thing to do things for them. So it's important. Anything.
There's a very sweet episode in the Ananda Vrindavan Champu where
where Nanda Baba's and Yashoda's parenting is described by Krishna's Kavi Karnapur. Very sweet. You know how Yashoda Mai was... Oh, the gopis came and complained about Krishna's naughtiness. And Yashoda, and then Krishna feigns innocence and tells Mother Yashoda not to believe in any of the gopis' complaints because it's not true. And then Yashoda, while looking at the gopis and smiling, Krishna doesn't see that. He is saying, how can you complain so much about my little child? He's so innocent, etc., etc. And, you know, then finally Nanda Baba, then the gopis are leaving and Nanda Baba, and then Mother Yashoda is chastising Krishna, you know, in front of the gopis. He's saying, oh, he's so innocent like this. Then, but when they're alone, he said, you didn't do good. You can act like this in our home. You can steal the butter and do this and that. But in other people's home, it's not becoming. And also... saying something naughty things to the gopis or urinating or whatever in their chambers like this. This is not becoming. So then she chastises him. Then he starts crying even more. Then he starts really crying. And then Nanda Baba's coming in. And then he's asking what is going on. And then Krishna says, now, Mother Yashoda, you tell truthfully what was going on. And so then Yashoda is describing everything, the complaints of the gopis. And then Nanda Baba, while again smiling at Yashoda, he is chastising Yashoda. How can you think so bad of my child? He is doing is such a wonderful child. He never does anything wrong and, you know, like this and that. And then he said... Then Krishna jumps on the lap of Nanda Baba and hugs him. And then he said, so Krishna, I tell you, you shouldn't go back into the lap of Yashoda. And then he becomes totally emotional and he jumps off the lap of Nanda Baba and runs back to Yashoda Ji and embraces her. So like this back and forth, you know, of... believing him and saying he's innocent and the other one is chastising, throwing the ball back and forth like this. That is just like what you're describing the parents should have. One should be a little strict and the other one should be a little lenient. So the child has, you know, and at the end comes to, he is both. He gets a good instruction, but also gets a loving embrace of the other parent like that.
Very nice story. So, yes. So now here we conclude our slide presentation, and we have another question and answer session tomorrow. What time is it, Prabhu? 8 to 10. So if 8 in the morning to 10. Yeah, the question and answers for the parenting group is that's what time? 6 to 8, 6 to 9. Okay, so we can continue with that.
Thank you all very much for your attention. As just in summary, homeschooling, our attempt in this homeschooling presentation has been to try to give an educational alternative that is being used now by a lot of people around the world. It's something that's only just getting started in India. And it's not something that will work for everyone. It's not something that works in all circumstances. But for many people, it can be an excellent alternative for whatever other educational options they have available. Right? And so to do it here in India, one has to be a real pioneer. Homeschooling is not well known. It's kind of the situation is what it was like. The situation is what it was like in the United States maybe, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago. right? That's the situation now in India. It's not something that's well known. It's something that often has a lot of opposition to it or a lot of skepticism and so forth. So people who do it now, and there are people who are doing it, it's a great, they're pioneers, right? It's a great challenge, and it takes a lot of courage and determination. But it's something that really does work. There's the experience of so many people all around the world, and even in this own method that my mother's been describing, there have been a number of families who have tried it and gotten very good results, kind of focusing on Srila Prabhupada's books as the medium of education. A couple things here. We have these handouts. Please take one per family as you leave. This has in it the printouts of the slides, as well as a number of articles that my mother has written on various aspects of home education and Krishna conscious parenting. For example, discipline in a Krishna conscious household, deity worship for children, celebrating festivals, field trips and vacations, all kinds of different aspects of home education. And these are posted on the website for the ISKCON Ministry of Educational Development. One thing I always forget to mention in advance is that we are very grateful to the ISKCON Ministry of Educational Development. They've recently given their blessings to this concept of homeschooling and also this specific method that we're presenting you in this seminars. So if you go to their website at iskoneducation.org, then iskoneducation.org, you can find a lot of different resources for ISKCON education. If you click on the link for homeschooling, you'll find a page with all my mother's articles. But also there's a lot of other things that may be useful to you. There's another page for Sunday school, Krishna Conscious Sunday School, in which there's contacts of a devotee who publishes a curriculum for that. You'll find articles by Mother Urmila. You'll find news about ISKCON education around the world. Right? So what I thought I'll do is I'll list a few of these things on the screen here so it's easier to take. The one I wrote up last time, that was a different slideshow. But here's a couple of things. Actually, two things are here. These are the main things anyway. So the website I'm talking about, the ISKCON Ministry of Educational Development. That is... This is iskoneducation.org. I think you'll have to actually www.iskoneducation.org. Okay. And the one on the top, this is a Yahoo group that my mother runs, specifically for families interested in homeschooling. You can sign up, go to this website, www.krishnahomeschool.com. And this is a website which will, it's not a website really, that web address will take you directly to the page where you can sign up for the Yahoo group. And the Yahoo group basically is people sign up and then they send questions about homeschooling to my mother if they're... have a particular question in the process, and then my mother responds to it for the whole group. And that way, it works a little bit better than individual email, because sometimes all the emails take up a lot of time. And this way, everyone can benefit from the answer, because many people have similar questions. So you're welcome to come and join, sign up for that group. If you do register for your sign up, there's a little paragraph where you can explain your reason and just identify yourself, who you are, and that you attended this seminar, so she knows. Also, I'll just write down here her personal email address in case you'd like to get in touch with her. So this is her personal email address, arudha108@yahoo.com. Okay. And she's happy to receive email messages as well. So thank you all very much for your attention. for giving us this opportunity to address you on this topic, especially those who have been attending previous seminars. Thank you for being with us for these many hours together. We really appreciate your association. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. So we are extremely grateful to Radhika Raman Prabhu, of course, his parents, Aruddha Mataji and Anantaru Prabhu, for coming here, taking such a trouble. In fact, actually, he was about to cancel the whole trip. He thought it's not very worth it coming for only for 3 days. But because Varshi Anant Prabhu's insistence, he was very disturbed that they are not coming. So he was up till 12 o'clock in the night. And he insisted that we call that they should come here. And they kindly agreed to come. And they were thinking that 3 days is not so beneficial for us to come and spending so much of money to of Radha Gopinath. But we can assure that only one session was enough